Today's show is brought to you by RX Bar. For 25% off your first order, visit rxbar.com/GOT and use promo code GOT at checkout. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 3, titled Queen's Justice. The Queen's Justice. Which queen? I think I know.
There's two queens, and they're both dispensing justice. I mean, Cersei is the most obvious justice dispenser.
Yeah, she gets the most justice.
Yep. Dispensing straight out her butthole. Just like you're back home.
Is that a thing?
I've been watching a lot of Rick and Morty lately. It's a Rick and Morty joke.
I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, you should watch each episode a dozen times over the last year. Also, Dany has taken Jon prisoner. Like, I felt like that her whole stance against Jon was very presumptuous. However, she also has three dragons and a much larger army and a much better, clearer claim to the throne, and was not even informed about the war that he's fighting until he showed up. So I guess it all makes sense. From her perspective, this should be a done deal.
Yeah, no, I thought on second watch, this is, with a few minor exceptions, this is a really strong episode. It has a surprising amount of humor in it.
Yeah.
And I felt it was much needed going into these final two seasons. We need to keep it at least somewhat light. You can't just have it be this downward spiral into pure blackness,
right?
Which the palette seems to be going. So we need a little bit of tonal lightening, which I think the humor did well.
And I did enjoy the light Han Solo-ing Lando Calrissian going on between Tyrion and Jon.
Because
you're not sure I don't know. I think Tyrion's doing a good job of playing the kind of the parent trapping of the two people.
You do? Because
I will say that he's not doing a great job as Hand, if we're just going by the evidence of his the fact that Cersei and Jaime are out plotting him does not bode well for Dany's military adventure. She needs people with more battlefield experience advising her.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the thing I took away from this episode is that Tyrion makes a great diplomat. He does not necessarily make a great military advisor.
Yeah.
And that's evidenced by the double defeat, essentially.
Right.
Last episode and this episode, he gets served a heaping helping of Queen's justice.
Without a boat full of wildfire and brawn, he ate nothing. But that's so weird because, well, I guess he's got wildfire class weapons. He's just read it. He doesn't want to use them against the people.
Yeah.
It's one thing to use them against, you know, like if Dany were holed up in the Red Keep and all the citizens were, and it was just an army of assholes outside the gates, I'm sure he'd let fire at the dragon.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He's in a tough spot.
Yeah. He had no problem in Marine when she blew up a bunch of boats.
Yeah. We're just discussing our general thoughts on the episode. I've already jumped analysis. Sorry. I'm chafing at the bit.
There were some really, really good shots. Excellent shots of like castles and cliffs and sea. And
that brooding cliff was amazing.
That was amazing. Yeah. I thought when we went to Highgarden, there was like a particularly amazing shot.
Of all the guys on the field, the field leading up to the castle.
Oh, that was at Casterly Rock, right?
No, I'm talking about when the combined turncoat Tyrells and Lannister armies was advancing towards it.
That was great. But there was also a shot of like a tower where there was a balcony kind of out, looking over the sea
and the
rocks, and it was just a beautiful shot.
Yeah.
And this show, you know, is kind of known for those, so the fact that this stood out means it was extra awesome.
Yeah. I was slightly while we're talking about the visual travelogue aspects, I was slightly disappointed in Casterly Rock.
A lot of people were. I'm not a book reader, and I've never seen an illustration
to any Wikipedia article, you'll see the kind of canonical illustration from, I believe, one of the what's the board game company? Fantasy Flight.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just like this big rock that's vaguely – it's like it's vaguely in the shape of like a sphinx with its head cut off or something. Like it kind of looks like it might have – like it's not a one-to-one, but it looks like it might have – you can see where like the lion association kind of came from. Mm-hmm. This, it just looked like a regular old castle.
I mean, that's the thing.
The other thing, the fact that we didn't get a clockwork casterly rock, this is, you know, it's a.
Yeah.
I guess I was unreasonably let down because, as Tyrion said, this is the seat. This is the where the true power in Westeros and has been talked about a lot, but we've never seen it. And I thought, like, when we finally see it, it's going to be badass. And it was just another castle, and it didn't even get a spot on the map. Like, people have no idea what fucking coast it's on. Like, and you know, I mean, if you've been paying attention, you should know that it's on the west side of Westeros.
On the exact opposite side of
it's
Dragon
on the western
Stone
Westeros,
and
but
King's Landing. Yeah.
But you have to really been paying attention to the dialogue and you know the province it's located in and all that. And I just don't understand why, since it seemed like it was a vital point on the map that they didn't show it. Now the cynic in me is like, because there's so much rampant jetpacking that maybe. In the Double D's minds, it's better to have that a little ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Could be. Or it's just not going to be a thing for very long. It's like, okay, there's this one battle here, and then we move on.
Right.
And we never see Casterly Rock again.
That's just a bummer to me. I was a little bummed out about that.
Or it could be that it's coming up next episode. Maybe there's like a bunch of scenes with Grey Worm and stuff at Casterly Rock deciding what the hell to do.
It's going
to
transform into a giant robot.
Sure, yeah. And it will march across the countryside
faster
than anyone thought possible.
The little known prophecy of Jaime waking stone lions from whatever. It's going to be crazy.
Melisandre's on that. She knows.
Oh, yeah.
She knows what's up.
Yeah, she's down there breathing fire.
And then, of course, we get like a really, really great death scene from one of the most beloved characters, I think. Certainly one of my favorites, Olenna.
Were you disappointed that she didn't collapse as Jaime was walking out the door?
I'm disappointed he didn't gut her from guts to butts.
Yeah,
I wanted to see her
that
Joffrey thing.
It was a great death scene, or it was a great death dialogue, but I felt like it needed an exclamation point. Either... Jamie's like, well, talk all the shit you want, old woman. You're still dying. And that point made as she collapses when he walks at the door. Or, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Look, don't give her the painless, satisfying death she wants.
Knife. My son's sword's called the Widow's Wail? You're in black? Are you a widow now? Oh, okay.
You know, I'm kind of surprised he didn't do that. But I guess he was just so shocked by the reveal there.
Look, guys, it's a thorn kebab. Like I said, I still really like this episode, but some of the technical and logistic details started bothering me a little bit more on second watch.
Hmm. Okay. I'm mostly overlooking that stuff because...
You have to.
You have to at some point. Otherwise,
it's kind of like, you know, like if you're halfway through John Wick and you're just like, oh, well, this constant headshotting is preposterous.
Right. Like, no man has that accuracy. Come on.
You're watching the wrong movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do feel like... I feel the people that... I mean, this isn't exactly halfway through John Wick. This is like you've watched 2 hours and there's 10 minutes to go, and it was a hyper realistic, you know, military political thriller, and then he just wins all his fights by headshotting everybody at the end. Like, I feel people that are there is a growing discontent with how much things are getting just thrown together and just for sake of dispensing with plot. And again, I don't know that it's the Double D's have suddenly forgotten how to tell a compelling TV story, because my first watches are always like very impressive, and I think that maybe, you know, if their chief crime is that you know, they were handed this thing and forced to finish something they didn't want to do, and you know, we're overthinking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, I don't know that the person to get mad at is at Double D's. The person to get mad at is George Martin, because they have to wrap this up in 2 seasons.
Yeah, I'm not actually sure why they're going with 2 seasons. I don't know why they don't extend this. If they've got so much to do, it's not like they can't afford
the
it, right? They're
is,
making money hand over fist with this thing. So.
I do, but I think I've gotten the impression that the Double D's are over it.
Well,
and that's the
I wonder if that's not showing in the work, because I do think a lot of this is... somewhat sloppy. We'll talk about it when we get to the Euron stuff.
Yeah.
I have my nitpicks, but overall, I really like the episode.
Yeah. No, no, and that's maybe something we can expand upon later, but I do, like, I think the Double D's are over it. it's bummer for us as a fan that we're not getting the entire story that we probably deserve. If I put myself in the Double D's shoes, it's hard for me to criticize them because they wanted to adapt this thing they were big fans of and they thought it would be finished. And, you know, the adaptation's already hard. Switching to original creative work in the middle is even harder. So, I don't know. It's that's one of the compelling things about these seasons is how unprecedented it is and you know, what the different things that different fan bases want from it. And we never think about what the creators want. And, you know, they're not slaves. They're no more our bitches than George Martin is. So sure. They like, hey, you know what? We've been doing this for 8 years, and it's been our life.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be like, you know, like what a big part of your life, like college and med school is for doctors. This has been like Game of Thrones for us, and we're done. We want out. We don't want any part of the fucking prequels or the sequels. We just want out and do other things.
Yeah.
We want to write for Always Sunny, and that's fine.
Okay.
That's
fine. Okay. Maybe we should get into the recap.
Let's do it.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, before we move on, I want to talk about some housekeeping stuff. Just a reminder to everybody, we got the spoiler edition of the podcast coming out Friday, which despite its name, it does not traffic in production spoilers. So anything Unfortunately, HBO got hit with another big leak. Yeah. The surfaced yesterday. Apparently, at least one in a future episode of Game of Thrones was stolen, if not more. Be super careful as you're searching out there. Like, I almost got spoiled with a Facebook thing from the leak. So it's I don't know. Yeah,
hot
like
out there.
It's as bad as it's been since like 2 years ago when like the entire like the first four or five episodes were leaked. And
yeah.
It just seems like it's just a shitty thing for the fan community because it's like now not everyone has the water cooler experience of Sunday night and some people know more and you don't know what they know and it sucks. But to the extent humanly possible, we do not talk about that on the spoiler edition. It's just fun book at this point, it's essentially just really fun book details that you wouldn't have gotten in the show that we use to try to figure out what's coming next or little historical details and like trivia from the books. It's a lot of fun. So if you're an adventuresome show watcher and you're not going to get your hair blown too far back by some obscure prophecies, you'd probably enjoy listening to it. That's coming out Friday, as always. We also, on Thursday night, will be seeing The Dark Tower, Stephen King's adaptation. Not an adaptation, a loose sequel, a prequel, I'm not sure, but of his beloved series, The Dark Tower. It's got Idris Elba and Matthew McConaughey. Those are 1A and 1B of my kryptonite, so I'm excited about that. We'll have a full we'll have a spoiler-free review Thursday night and a full spoiler podcast for the club members. I did a Twin Peaks podcast with a David Lynch fan and expert, Shane Bowman. I've done a lot of podcasts with him in the past. We did one last week, released it Thursday, about the classic series. We're going to be doing an upcoming series about the return, Twin Peaks The Return. Also this week, Rick and Morty had its season 3 premiere, the first two episodes this Sunday. Jim and I will be talking about that on Bald Move Television, too. You can find all that stuff on baldmove.com. Also, for club members, Wednesday, we got a new quip, Quit Your Pitching, coming out. Lots of stuff coming out this week at Bald Move. You can find it all on baldmove.com.
We start off with Jon arriving at Dragonstone, and he's greeted by Tyrion and Missandei, and she asks them to surrender their weapons and their boat as well. He doesn't really agree to that, but it happens anyway. They comply, and they head into the castle. And as they do, Drogon does a flyby on him.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of good dialogue here.
Permission to buzz the tower.
Yeah, they didn't ask for permission. He Top Gunned it.
Yeah.
Straight up Top Gunned him. Yeah. It's funny how they react versus how like Tyrion and Missandei and the other soldiers react. Because they react to it, but it's more like, oh, there goes Drogon doing his thing.
Right.
But Jon and Davos hit the deck, man.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's...
For good reason.
Well, I mean, imagine, like, if you... Yeah. Like, how hard we get used to a super predator like that in the skies. Like, something the size of a jumbo jet that you can just come screaming down and breathe fire on you. And it's also hard to not get the impression that dragons are just kind of fucking with them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? It's like every time, sometimes when I walk past my cat, she'll just reach out and, like, grab my ankle. And I feel it's like, you know, kind of like, hey, if you were one-tenth your size, I would kill and eat you now. And I feel like the dragons are doing that, except for they are like 10 times bigger than humans. So I don't know. I guess they don't. How does Dany teach them not to eat people or her people specifically?
I don't know. It's that connection, I guess.
Yeah.
She just says, hey, these are my friends.
Yeah. Go eat some goats or maybe go fly to King's Landing. That's the other thing. She also doesn't want them flying. Can you imagine if they just like flew to King's Landing and started eating people or got themselves killed by these stupid crossbows? Like, what do you do? What do you do about these dragons, man?
Yeah, it was nice to see Jon and Tyrion reunited. They've always had a bit of a rapport that I enjoyed.
Yeah, the reminiscing. Like, you know, anytime characters call back to things they've done many, many years ago, I feel like it's rewarding as a fan because, like, we get those references, and it's nice that the characters do and which means the creators do.
Mm-hmm.
So having them not just be generic, like, it's been a long time, like, but specific interactions, them calling each other dwarf and bastard and referencing Tyrion pissing off the wall.
Yeah.
That stuff is cool. I like it.
And talking about, you know, catching up with each other, you know, Tyrion's talking about Sansa. I think he's trying to do a little damage control here.
Yeah.
Look, Jon, it was not my fault. Yeah, like I didn't want anything to do with it. It was never consummated. Like, just
I don't know what she told you, but from my perspective,
right.
Yeah. I thought that was handled pretty well, especially since John is like, he kind of like, I'm ready to stop talking about it before it begins. And Tyrion's like, hey, just wanted you to know.
Yeah, and John doesn't have a great explanation for how he got to where he is either.
What do you think is up with Missandei just shutting down Davos? Like, I felt like there was... here's the thing. I feel like the mind games began as soon as John, like, asking him to give up his weapons, taking his boat, buzzing his dragons, having your advisor give your Missandei and Davos are essentially equals and peers.
Yeah.
And she just shuts down his small talk, not rudely, but with, like, a bemused smile. Like, everything about this situation is designed to tell John, you are a small and insignificant thing. Look at this great and powerful Oz.
Yeah, I really dislike the attitude in these throne room scenes.
Yeah.
I understand where both sides are coming from here.
Right.
Like, Danny doesn't know this guy from a hole in the ground. He's talking some crazy shit. She's not going to believe it. But at the same time, her positioning of herself is incredibly stupid in my mind, because I know why John's there.
Yeah.
But I get it. I get it.
But on the other hand, I also think that Tyrion, some of this is Tyrion's fault, because John showed up to, you know, talk with this new queen. She is expecting him to bend the knee. So when she sees him come here and he's like, it's and since Tyrion did not see fit to communicate that knowledge, it creates a bit of built-in friction, because she's like, well, he's here, so why would he be here if not to do the things that I ask him to do in the message?
Yeah, Tyrion is the villain of this scene.
Yeah.
Between Jon and Dany.
Yeah. Like, it is a little troubling that this is how Dany decided to treat, you know, a potential respected ally. Like, again, like... I don't know. Like, asking your liege lord to bend the knee is not unreasonable. But if that was the thing, like, if you thought this was going to be a cordial occasion and just going to, why all the crazy intimidation?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
They're really leaning her in that Mad Queen direction. She's talking about, I'm the rightful ruler. Like, I will sit on the throne. I will rule. I have faith in me.
Yeah.
Like, I understand a lot of why she's saying that, but she doesn't quite understand how that comes across to other people.
Exactly. And I thought that, like, what came out of her mouth when John confronted her with the fact that her dad, you know, murdered two of his family members.
Yeah.
That's something very Viserys that he would say. Like, oh, well, of course, we'd like to ask for your official pardon and forgiveness.
Right. And John makes a perfect point there when he says, look, you're not your father, and I'm not beholden to the oaths of my father.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
Let's just dispense with all this bullshit and let's do what needs to be done for the realm.
Right.
Maybe if Varys was in that room, it goes a little bit different, because he could defend the realm a bit. But
yeah, I had a lot of people in my feedback ask why Varys didn't play a more proactive point about, like, actually, Your Grace, his father tried everything. He resigned a handship to keep you from being assassinated.
Uh-huh.
Like, that wasn't the way he rolled.
Yeah.
I felt like there's a little bit of artificiality to making these characters bicker and fight.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why they're doing it, but it feels like a pumping of the narrative brakes that they've already – it feels like they've slammed on the brakes since the beginning of this season.
No, I mean, really, like, I don't have a huge problem narratively from, like, this scene. What I have a problem with is being a fan and wanting to see these two come together and fight the Night King and kick some ass, and they're just not doing it yet.
And then it's also frustrating, because it seems like between all their advisors, they have all the pieces. It's kind of like watching a rom-com where, like, if the two protagonists would just fucking talk about the situation for 5 minutes... it would be nothing, but instead it's like, oh my God, all these stakes because nobody's talking. Like, why is that not happening? Why does she privately talk to Tyrion? I guess she doesn't have the same level of trust in Varys.
Sure.
But, you know, he should be in the room, right?
Yeah, I don't know where. I mean, he's up talking to Melisandre at that point.
He's more interested in, because I know that's the thing. Like, Varys, I guess that's true to his character. He hates magic practicers with a passion. So maybe it's more important for him to shine her on than to give his queen faithful counsel. Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. That's at least consistent with his character, I suppose.
Sure. I will talk about that scene in a moment. The one other thing that I had to note in the meeting of John and Danny is how much Dani is speaking for herself and saying, I'm important. Like, yes. I'm the one who's going to lead all these people. Whereas John doesn't say hardly a word here. You know,
right.
the things that are spoken of John and his importance are spoken by Davos. And that's indicative of how, like, the people have chosen to make John the king, right? He hasn't chosen to make himself the king.
Right.
He doesn't care necessarily about that. What he's looking for is to try and save the realm.
Right.
I just couldn't help but notice the difference between the two there.
And that's what I felt that she felt, and that this is actually, I think, intentional. She felt ill at ease at this because it's not like she asked to be the Khaleesi and the breaker of chains and the mother of dragons. Like, most of the things that she did were what she thought was in her people's best interests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try to save Khal Drogo, try to save their child who's going to be the stallion that mounts the world, try to take the cast-offs of the Khalasar and get him through the Red Wastes, try to get him out. You know, like, she's tried to make the six to be, and to free the slaves to make the world a better place, and now she's in Westeros, and, you know, she's smart enough to know that people aren't drinking secret toast at her health. Like, it's not – she doesn't have nearly as much mandate. Like, now that she's in Westeros, she had this mandate to break the chains and to free the slaves and make people's lives better. Now she's in Westeros, she really is leaning on her name claim.
Mm-hmm.
And she's smart enough to know how weak that is, but also that's – you know, that's the thing. Her and Jon are both inexperienced and not ready for the moment they're in.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
You know, John's seen the Night King and she hasn't. That's the difference between them.
Yeah. Okay, let's back up here for a second. We kind of already talked about the John and Dany meeting scene, but we didn't talk about Varys and Melisandre. Varys meets her up on a cliff and he's questioning why she's avoiding John. She says, look, I've made some mistakes in my past and we didn't part on good terms. So she's apparently leaving for Volantis rather than face John.
Mm-hmm.
And Varys says, oh, you won't be safe if you ever return to Westeros. And she said, I have to die here just like you.
Very interesting.
I'm thinking, no, not Varys.
Yeah.
Not Varys. He's my boy.
I kind of feel like I slightly like Varys more than Tyrion at this stage.
Might agree with
that. All the eunuch jokes in season 5 and 6 uh-huh. and the fact that the Varys is always – and his stirring speech about – being for the realm, because I don't know, Tyrion has got a lot of his ambition is like personal pride and proving his family wrong and proving his dad wrong in particular. Where Varys, you know, he had nothing. Everything he's gotten, he had to work for, and he still wants to serve the realm. He's like he's the anti Littlefinger, who has amassed all this stuff just personally for himself. You know, I think that's really interesting. And at some point along the way, I feel like I like Varys slightly more than Tyrion. And I feel like that maybe if Varys was in the hand position, things might have turned out better. I don't know.
I'd rather be too cautious. I'd rather have Varys advising me. I'd rather have a beer with Tyrion.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure.
But it's super ominous. Like, I'm hoping that this is one of Melisandre's misplaced prophecies.
That's true.
She's seen something that she thinks lines up with Varys, but it doesn't actually, because I don't want him to go.
Right.
I want him to stick around. That's pretty much it up on the cliff.
Also, they said I brought ice and fire together.
Right.
Like, that's very close to saying the title, but not quite.
Right.
There needs to be a song in there. That's where Sam needs to come in, give it the poetic title.
He'll write a book eventually. He's probably writing it right now.
Probably.
So after the meeting with John and Dany, we go over to Theon, who's pulled out of the ocean. He tries to claim that he tried to save Yara, but the crew rightfully doesn't believe him. They call bullshit on that. And he's left on the deck to freeze and think about it.
Oh, can we go back to Dany and John real quick?
Yeah.
We didn't talk more. It's been 2 more days to think about it. Why do you think that John is so hesitant to let Davos run down his full resume? Is it because
mean where he cuts him off with a knife in the heart?
Yeah, my thing is, like, he's already asking him to believe something incredible,
right?
Like, I don't want us to sound like raving madmen.
Yeah,
like, I've got the army of the dead, and like I arguably am part of that dead army of the dead, you know, like I'm a guy that got resurrected. Maybe that's the best I can come up with.
Yeah, so I totally think that's the thing. Like, we're making one big ask. Let's not make 2.
Okay.
The thing that throws the wrench in it for me is that Dany herself admits that crazy fucking things happen, right? Like, people hadn't seen dragons for hundreds of years before I came on the scene, and yet I birthed them. So, really, you're gonna really question that hard what this guy's
trying to tell
you. On the
other
hand,
I guess Dani has all of her evidence arrayed. Like, all that stuff that she said, she says, you've seen my dragons, you've seen my Khalasar, you've seen my eunuch army. Like, John is like, well, yeah, but there's this bigger threat.
So you should also say, and I've seen the Night King, and I've seen the White Walkers.
But that's true. He could say that, but it's faith versus reason.
Like, for sure.
Danny's not asking for his faith. John is.
Yeah, and she has faith in herself alone. So, okay, let's go on to Euron. He comes back leading his captives through the streets of King's Landing, and he revels in the cheers of the crowd. He brings them to the Iron Throne, where Cersei promises him everything he wants, once the war is over, of course, and makes him commander of the naval fleet. And while the crowd cheers, Euron taunts Jaime. I think this is a really good scene. Euron, like, I love to hate Euron.
You know,
it's one of those things.
And also, boy, Jaime is just always comes off the weaker on this, because he tries to be the elder statesman. It's like, oh yeah, well, let me tell you a thing or two about the mob, and then you're on like out real politics. I'm like, yeah, I just think they're like severed heads, bro. Also, does your sister like it in the bum? And then as Jamie's like, you know, incandescing with rage, he does that shh, we'll talk later.
You think they're gonna talk?
Quote unquote, there will be further words said. Do you think I don't quite have Euron figured out, honestly. He seems to exist solely as a plausible way for Cersei to be stymieing the early parts of Daenerys's conquest. And not even a very artistic one at that. Because again, I'm not going to bitch about jetpacking, but I want to speak for the people that are really bothered by it. The timeline, as the show has us believe, which again, indeterminate amounts of time can pass between any of these scenes. However, what's presented is he intercepts Dany's fleet outside of Dragonstone, drags them back, and does his victory procession. And by the end of the episode, has sailed around the entire continent in time to be at the exact position to destroy the rest of her fleet.
Yeah.
Now, I guess there's no evidence that Euron was actually there. He could have like sent his men, but does that seem very Euron? And that's also me appealing to things that are not in evidence.
Sure.
Because that's the other thing, is like, I got like 50 different emails about possible ways that Euron could get 1,000 ships. And I'm like, well, yeah, he also could have a matter replicator he discovered in old Valyria, and he's got installed
on a pike.
He's
got a ship horn. He blows a horn and ships come out.
Come out like a horn of a ship plenty. Like, you could say many, many things. But
I've seen the ship horn, Danny. It's real. Trust me.
It's in his pants. I mean, that's the thing. Like, if you are, you can make up any story, but you're just writing fan fiction.
Sure.
And that's the thing, is like, you know, I guess that's what the Double D has been saying all along, is what Double D's are doing. It's officially licensed fan fiction. And I hate it when it feels that way. So, like, I'm going to try not to talk about jetpacking the rest of the episode, but there it is.
Yeah, I wonder what they're doing with Euron beyond that, because he's definitely set up as a foil for Jaime at this point. Like, he is getting under Jaime's skin. And I don't think he can just kill Jaime. I don't think Cersei would tolerate that.
Well,
but he might be able to make some kind of claim of self-defense if he can goad Jaime into making a mistake.
And here's that. I think this is a little bit of self-inflicted wound from the fan fiction. I think they've kept Jaime on Cersei's side way too fucking long.
Yeah.
And they need something like Euron to be like a flaming stick in his eye to provoke him into some kind of rift between him and Cersei, because
I thought the wildfire was going to be that, honestly.
Yeah, like, you burnt half of this. Like, I literally slew the other king to stop that. Like, how can this still be cool? But I don't know. I feel like that was a flaw in their approach that they kind of seeded back in seasons 4 and 5, and now they need something like Euron to solve a bunch of their different sins.
Yeah.
So what are you going to
do? I mean, if they're even going that way, you know?
That's true.
They might stay true blue to each other till the end.
That's true. I could have completely misunderstood the arc of Jaime and Cersei.
Or they're just not doing that in the show.
Yeah.
You know?
That's also possible.
So then we go to Cersei taunting Ilaria in the dungeons before kissing to death the final sand snake with the same poison that Ilaria used to kill Myrcella. Tyene? Is that her name? I never bothered to learn their names.
And this is the thing that bums me out, because I thought that Tyene and Ilaria did excellent in this scene.
I thought Ilaria, the actress who played Ilaria, crushed it in this scene.
And I know I mentioned this in years past, but I read another article where they interviewed the Sand Snakes and just how bummed they were that the fans didn't like them. And it's not your fault, guys. It's
your
totally
dialogue was terrible.
And this scene is getting, like, I forgot that Ilaria was good. Mm-hmm. You know, I forget the actress's name, but she really, with nothing but her eyes and her body language, is emoting the shit out of this. And like, man, if they gave, like you think if they gave her and the Prince Doran, I can't remember Dr. Bashir's name, Julian something or other.
Yeah, Julian Assange. It's like, it's,
if they'd just given them some leaks, now we got it. If the material they gave it was the bad, it wasn't any. I don't think it's any one of these individual actors, and it's really tough to like get cast this and be so excited, and they were so pumped for what they thought was going to happen, and then everybody hates them, and it's nothing that they did wrong. It's just the material they were given.
Yeah.
So just want to say it's not your fault, guys. It's too bad the Sand Snakes were kind of botched. The whole Dorne thing got botched. But at least they gave you two a pretty good. They gave Mama Snake and Baby Snake a pretty good out.
They did. And I've never really had a problem with Ilaria as a character. I thought she was good and well written. Her scenes, you know, back when Oberyn was still alive, were really good.
Yeah.
It's really just the Sand Snakes. But that's not what we're here to talk about. You can see from the very first moment that Cersei steps on screen, speaking of actors who crushed it in this scene, Lena Headey does another incredible job here, just being I don't even know the word for it, but there's something that you like. This is the queen's justice, right? She deserves this moment, I think, even though she's a monster of a human being. All of that comes through on the screen with her performance. It's great.
Right. But, you know, the thing is Ilaria, Cersei's got a point.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Like Oberyn brought all this, like, onto himself. You know, that's something that was always frustrating. Like, he was such an awesome character, but he shit the bed.
Yeah.
When, you know, instead of just, you know, being content to strike a blow at House Lannister, he had to get the whole thing. He had to get a complete, total, and psychological victory over them, and he got himself killed, which just directly led to this moment. And, you know, Cersei's a scorpion. You can't blame a scorpion for stinging. And you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. These people are going to die in particularly horrible, horrific ways. I mean, I don't know if this is any worse than a nun being fucking raped and abused repeatedly by some zombie.
Oh, no.
I don't know if it's any worse than blowing up hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people around the Sept of Baelor.
Yeah, that's
and,
more
and the seat of religious faith for an entire continent. Like, that's pretty repugnant shit.
Oh, yeah, Cersei's the worst by far, but she does deserve this moment because Myrcella was a casualty of Ilaria here, and I don't think Myrcella deserved it at all.
No, God, no. So, neither did – also Ilaria, neither did Trystane, Dorne's son.
Right.
So some of this is you reaping what you sow.
Yep.
You stepped a little bit. You gazed at the abyss of Cersei's butthole too long, and it gazed back. There you go.
Speaking of reaping what you sow, I can't help but notice the symmetry here of pointing out that Oberyn got killed as he was gloating because he was gloating. It was his downfall. Now, Cersei's doing the same thing. Like, maybe take it down a notch, Cersei.
I think she's just sharpening her diplomacy when the inevitable meeting with her and the Night King. Like, she's got to master this gloating-based language. And it's like Picard in that one episode where he was, you know, just trying to get it just right.
Right when the ambassador's coming.
She has to get this gloating just right so that she can treat with the Night King when he comes down.
Yep. Okay, afterward, Cersei goes to bang Jaime. The next morning, there's a knock on the door. Cersei opens it to reveal the relationship to this messenger.
The
who
Romulan,
says,
Romulan sub-commander that came to tell her what's up.
She came to say that the visitors from Braavos have arrived. which means Iron Bank is here.
Mm-hmm.
Cersei just being super cavalier about this whole relationship.
I think she can be. The one thing they kept on showing is that, like, every time I thought it was striking when she was addressing the lords of, you know, the lords and ladies of court, how small, like, you compare to, like, when when Sansa and Joffrey's wedding was announced, and, like, there was just the hall was packed, and, like, the antechambers were packed, and the balconies were packed, mm-hmm. and now there's, like, 3 dozen people standing in, and half of that is the Tyrell people. I feel like that there's really, like, everyone that was anyone was at that trial, and now there's nobody left to oppose her. I do think she can do what she'll please.
Yeah, that's the thing. You look at how many people were packed into that sept.
Yeah.
How many people she blew up.
And we know, like, Kevin Lannister, Mace Tyrell, like, there was just tons of people that were...
A lot of the nobles would have been in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's...
And their families who weren't in there would be rightfully pissed.
Right. So... And you also think that, like, I mean, I guess, can she do anything, like... No, because eventually the people will rise up and eat her if they're starving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably not a good look that she vaporized again. You know, whatever the lords and ladies believe, the small folk are super pro gods.
Yeah.
And that's got to be something that's seen as an open insult. So no, she's not totally safe, but I don't think she has to worry about her servant girl seeing her boning her brother at this point.
Yeah.
Especially since that's kind of been an open secret for years now.
Right. They just wouldn't admit it.
Stannis put her on blast back in season 2 on this with all those ravens.
Yeah, I mean, Ned did. Yeah. Stannis
that's
did.
What I'm saying.
Everybody's
it's kind
it.
Of an open secret at this point. Euron fucking
dad.
Knows it. Euron's been sailing the 17 seas or however many seas there are in Westeros.
Yeah.
Westeros has too many seas.
For
7's good enough for Earth. Why do you need 29 or however many it was?
Then the guy from the Iron Bank, I don't know his name, he meets with Cersei to warn her that they're planning to back Dany if they don't get their gold back. Cersei makes a case for why they should support the crown in the war instead and promises a full payment within a fortnight.
2 weeks. That gives us an idea of the, that does give us an idea. 2 weeks is certainly long enough to sail around Westeros and flank another mm-hmm. army. So there's my own rebuttal to my jetpacking.
Yeah. I guess I don't know how exactly they timed it. Because there's no, like, direct link between the timing of the Casterly Rock stuff and the timing of the Highgarden stuff. So
we just know sometime between the next 2 weeks she'll have the gold. And we see by the end of the episode she has the gold.
She has the gold.
You saw that in subsequent watches.
I did.
Jamie just marching
wagons
past.
Full gold bricks.
Chest of gold brick. Yeah, yeah. It's a lot of money.
It is. Tons of money.
He's like, well, shit, no wonder our mines are empty. The Tyrells have got it all.
Yeah. I mean, that was the deal, right? They paid them gold in exchange for their crops.
Right.
To feed troops and civilians. And now they've just, like you said in the instant take, this is a great, great idea for them.
Right.
And
you trade, and then rob the port when it's out of goods.
It's interesting that Elena questions, like, why Tywin didn't just do this the moment the gold mines ran dry. And I think Tywin is actually a more decent human being than Cersei.
Not only
and
that.
He could have done this, but he chose not
there
to.
There was no percentage. Like as long as I can secure the Tyrells' undivided loyalty by marrying my grandson off to their daughters.
Yeah.
Like, why
and
would
he
I
gains their armies?
If Jaime lost 100 dudes in fighting, that's 100 dudes that Tywin wouldn't have lost because he'd have them on the hook for generations.
Right.
Like, their money would be his money.
And he'd have to defeat their army, and their army could be useful to him.
Exactly.
In an alliance.
So that's why, like, I think the banker of Braavos is sucking Cersei's dick a little too hard here, because there's no way Tywin would be put in this position. There's
sure.
no way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's of all the terrible choices left before you, you're picking the best of the terrible choices, but still there's no way Tywin had been put in this position.
Mm-hmm. Then we go over to Tyrion and Jon brooding on a cliff. Tyrion's upset because he can't brood as well as Jon does. They're discussing their various problems. Tyrion tries to defend Dany a little bit and then encourages Jon to ask for something more reasonable, and Jon just doesn't get it.
Yeah,
he tries multiple times, multiple paths, and finally just has to say it. Ask for the dragon glass, you dummy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I enjoyed the scene a lot, especially the humor from Tyrion. You know, I came up here to brood about my failure. You make me feel like I'm failing at brooding.
It's very meta too, because yeah. Like, you know, that's one of the things people say about, oh, he's just brooding. He's Kit Harington's portrayal of Jon. He's just a brooder. He's a yep. good looking brooder. I like it.
I do too. And then Tyrion goes to Dany and says Jon's asking for some dragon glass, and he convinces her to give Jon the glass.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't have been hard, because I felt like both of these leaders need to be led to the water a little bit more. It's like, look, if it's valueless and you didn't even know you had it, you can give him and take that right. first. Like, you can take a symbolic first step that cost you nothing to start winning his trust, because otherwise he can leave and neither of you have anything.
Yeah, like I said, I think Tyrion's a great diplomat, just not great at the military strategy, apparently.
Yeah. I also wonder if there's going to be a plot point with the fact that dragon glass will be more valuable than gold. Like John, because I'm starting to look at all the different things that we've been said. Like, John made that statement, like, dragon glass will be more valuable than gold in the winter. And Sansa talking about, like, food and the Reach has food and the Reach has gold. And, like, all these connections kind of, like, they got to be obvious. They got to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to put the pieces together. Not quite there yet, but I'm just noticing. I'm in the noticing stage right now.
Yeah. The pieces will come together eventually.
Like is that going to be a way that Cersei, like, will Cersei eventually be brought into this larger coalition
against,
like,
she'll Night
King? like the Night's King, and she doesn't have obsidian, but she's got all this gold, and like, they're gonna, is a way for them to pry food out from the Red Keep for the North? Or
I can't see Cersei working with anybody.
Well, I mean, I don't think she would be true blue about it, but I can see her being, you know, I just wonder if that's going to be something that the dumber good guys are going to fall for, the fact that, like, oh, yeah, I'll trade. Yeah, we need this obsidian. Or I don't know. Uh-huh. There's just something
she's
there.
She's going to invite Jon to come and treat with her. And
right.
He's going to accept, she's got the something we need. I don't know. Let's go there.
Well, I mean, she's got food. Like, that's the thing. Like, the only food game in town
in
the country is the Lannisters now.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to need dragonglass. They don't know it, but everyone needs food and everyone knows it, especially the North, because they're going to face the brunt of the winter sooner and harder than anybody else is.
Yeah.
So that's got to be significant.
And I also really like in this scene the humor between Dany and Tyrion, where he says, oh yeah, a wise man once said, and she's like, are you trying to pass off your own statements as ancient wisdom?
Was he?
I think so, yeah.
Then he, so because totally. I don't, so do you think he lied to her, but he, like, joke lied, so it's okay?
Yeah, yeah. All he right. tongue-in-cheek told her what she wanted to hear.
Okay.
And I think they both knew it.
All right. I think you're right. I thought it was a little ballsy. I thought as he was doing it, it's like, you know, maybe you should just say, I've always thought, or I've always said, because she clearly respects her intellect. I don't think you have to pass it off as ancient wisdom. But anyway.
Then Jon meets Dany on a cliff, and she says she hasn't changed her mind, and neither has Jon, but she'll allow him to mine the dragonglass and help him do it. She's going to give him... I mean, I guess Jon's just going to go back with mounds of dragonglass, you know?
Apparently so.
Fashioned into weapons, probably already.
Apparently so. But he's not going to be allowed to leave at this point either. Like, I feel like
Well, it's going to take some time to mine
that's
that
what I'm saying.
Glass,
yeah. Like, he's going to still be on Dragonstone for a bit, so him and Dany can still have these talks. I did like that. It was an odd moment when they bonded over their two lost brothers, because they implied that Jon's only lost two brothers, which, I mean, Rickon for sure is dead.
Rob is for sure dead.
And everyone thinks that Bran is dead.
Like, except Jon, who has seen him.
No, Bran saw Jon. Jon did not see Bran.
Oh, you might be right.
So I felt like that's a little bit of a continuity error, that, like, you know, everyone thinks that Bran's dead and he's not. And I almost wonder, like, maybe this was shot, because this happens in television, especially Game of Thrones, where everything's being shot simultaneously. I wonder if this scene was supposed to be after Jon knows his brother is not dead, and it just, in editing, it got assembled before. So it's, because that's the only thing that explains it. Like, she should have said, I've lost two brothers, but you've lost three.
Maybe John's looking for confirmed kills only.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe in Essos, it's like he's just missing in action instead of, like, actually. But
I don't know.
That's the other thing. It's like, did they ever, I genuinely don't know if the realm at large knows that Theon bullshitted about killing. Well, I mean, I guess they do because they actually found Rickon alive, mm-hmm. and he was killed later. So that would put the lie to fact of both of them. So maybe it is they're just missing.
I don't know. But yeah, so John's going to get, you know, you can't always get what you want, but you might get what you need. John's going to get the dragon glass. It's just going to take some time. Then we go over to Sansa, who is running Winterfell like a boss, I got to say.
Mm-hmm.
She says they need to build up the grain stores because tons of people might flee to Winterfell in this long night, in this winter. She also says they should cover the armor in leather, which I guess is an astute observation.
Yeah, I'm assuming that's just to make it more insulated.
Yeah, more
like you don't want plate steel right against your skin. But I wouldn't think that you would go naked underneath your plate steel anyway.
Yeah, I'm probably gonna wear something under it.
Maybe it keeps it like from sticking together. Like if it gets like you know, I don't know. I don't know how armor works, but. You know who does? Jon Royce. He was super impressed with her suggesting a leather covering, and that's what we're supposed to understand.
Yep.
Someone wants to give me the creative anarchist the guide to leather or metal weaponry and armor, then I'll be happy to read it.
I couldn't believe that the maester didn't know the longest winter in record off the top of his head.
I had the same notes.
I could not believe
it. I have my notes. What kind of bargain basement Maester Wolken we got here that, like, that should be...
Yeah.
Really?
I want Lewin back.
Yeah.
Honestly, he would have known.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. Like, that's the thing, you know, you've not, even though winter is coming and it's said that you just don't know.
Right. You've got the king in the north off getting dragon glass to fight the walkers and you don't know how long the last winter was?
Right.
Come on, man.
Yeah.
Like, you were probably alive for it, too.
Yeah, she's not asking, like, what's the best beach on the southern island to hit.
Right.
Like, I can understand. Like,
are you there to party? Are you there to relax? Like,
right.
Is it Ja spring break?
Is Ja Rule organizing this event? Or, you know, it's like, I feel like that he should know that.
He should definitely know that.
That should
but
be
he
something, the information he has at his fingertips. I'm skeptical of this Wolken guy.
Me, too. He's on watch. And I don't mean the night.
I think his
watch.
First name's Christopher.
Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken.
I doubt
it. I can't do Walken. Forget it.
And then Littlefinger tries to get a finger hold on Sansa by advising that she consider all the possible outcomes of the war.
It's his mental Churchill speech.
Yeah.
You must fight them in your frontal lobes. You must fight them in your cortexes. You must fight them on your hippocampus at all times. Be fighting mental battles. I mean, it is a good speech.
It's a good speech, and I think it's a lot good
people,
strategy.
A lot of people gave it shit coming out of Comic-Con, but I thought you astutely pointed out that in context it was it came off as not as desperate and more of – I mean, I kind of am back to like trying to decide how much he really cares about Sansa and wants to see her succeed.
Right. I do think this is good advice, and I think that's the thing that they're forgetting, right, is that there are two wars here happening.
Yes.
And you cannot ignore the possible outcome from the south just for the sake of the north.
Right. Especially since it's all in your head. Like, you know, he's not even saying you have to do anything. But if you're refusing to think about it, you're putting yourself and your people at it. You're doing a disservice to them both.
And you might miss an option that can solve both problems at the same time.
Right.
You know?
The only problematic thing is that I know that Sansa has seen Littlefinger scam a woman. Like to you know, bullshit her with flattery and lies and then throw her down a moon door. Like, she's seen this stuff happen. And to the extent that I think he's being true blue and he's like, how much of that is just an act? And I've seen him do it before. He'll probably do it again. Is he doing it to Sansa right now?
I'm kind of waiting for the reveal that this was all part of Littlefinger's plan.
Could be.
Like, to lose the trust of Sansa only to try to look like he's trying to regain it is part of his master plan somehow?
No, I don't know. I'm scared because I got a lot of feedback the last couple of weeks. Like, you guys are really underestimating Littlefinger. And you're like, yeah, you kind of.
I'm
like,
still waiting for his
It's
turn.
Just, it's purely a meta argument that he has to get to the end of his rope soon. Like,
sure.
Yep. There's nothing in the Game of Thrones that says that he can't even be the prime minister when all this is done. Like, I don't think he'll be on the Iron Throne. I don't even think there'll be an Iron Throne. But he, like, that would be pretty funny.
All right. And then
Robert de Bruce was the hero of Braveheart after he let, you know, betrayed Mel Gibson and his guts torn out. Like, sometimes sometimes your heroes aren't always what you want them to be in your history books.
It's true. Sansa's told there's someone at the gate, and she is reunited with Bran, who doesn't even bother, doesn't even lift a finger, let alone two arms, to give her a hug.
Yeah, I think... I mean, clearly, when I've watched this more, they're trying to imply that Bran is the three-eyed raven now, something he wasn't ready for, something he wasn't prepared for, and it's made him weird. He is essentially...
It's made him weird, yes,
he's essentially a Dr. Manhattan in a crippled body.
Yeah.
I do think that they could have done a better job showing his loss of humanity, so it's not as jarring. Because mm-hmm. that's the thing. It's not like, you know, fucking speaking of Dr. Manhattan, the Watchmen movie showed Dr. Manhattan losing his humanity in a 5-minute montage.
Mm-hmm.
I buy that, like, you, when you have this like unlimited cosmic intellect and access to all timelines, it would make you fucking weird, and you would have a hard time relating with people, and you would hurt them in ways that you wouldn't even consider, because, you know, that's the thing, like, the uncomfortable thing about Dr. Manhattan is, like, his girlfriend's giving him shit for, you know, doing a three-way with her while he's working on his top secret reactor next door, but, like, he's you're a child compared to him. Mm-hmm. Not even that. It's like some kind of fucked up bestiality. He's on another ascended plane, and he's just fucking with you out of being polite, essentially.
Yeah.
You can't really hate him for it. So I feel like they could have done a better job showing Bran go down that path, but it is I think it makes sense.
Yeah, I do understand.
And I think
most of what Bran does here, like, I guess this, first of all, this is the reason that Bran did not send, like, a raven or something. He was on his way down here from the jump, apparently.
Right.
He was just going to show up, you know, surprise everybody. But then this conversation he has under the tree with Sansa.
Uh-huh.
Yes, maybe he is the Dr. Manhattan of this situation, but does he not... How far has he gone down that road? Because he doesn't seem to understand that this memory would be difficult for Sansa... when he says, oh, how beautiful you looked on your wedding night. That was the worst fucking night of her life.
But I do think it was his fucked up way to, you know, it's like...
Why would he bother to try and compliment her and tell her how beautiful she looked if he couldn't also understand how fucked up of a thing happened to her that night?
It's like, I mean, if the Blood Raven or if the Three-Eyed Raven is like a mantle that he inherited, and as soon as the old man died, like, that stuff just jammed into his brain, it might have, like, you see what something like that did to Hodor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Willis went from being Willis to being Hodor in the flip of a switch.
Right.
So if all that current jammed through, like, again... I don't think they did a great job of explaining this.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that, like, post-fact, if you want to say, like, that all this stuff got jammed into his skull, and every single time he touches a weirwood now, he gets another jolt of this electricity, the fact that he is kind of like, I understand I'm supposed to do something to be loving as a brother here, but the inputs, like, he's like a now a highly functioning autistic person. And he has no he's got all these jumbles of memories and emotions,
and yet he can recognize what a beautiful visage she was in that moment.
Yeah,
but he can't recognize what a horrible thing happened.
I mean, isn't
to her
that
moments
what it's
later?
Like to be like Asperger's or autistic? Is to have the emotion and the intellect kind of divorced from each other. Like, I can recognize this as a pretty dress. I don't get the context of you being raped that night.
Okay.
In your own home. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm just saying.
But
again,
I don't know how that lines up with where Bran is on the spectrum.
Yeah, no,
he's
totally.
He's pinned at Three-Eyed Raven. Like, the needle has gone all the way around.
Yes. Again, they could have done a much better job with the transition, but I do feel like that's how... Now, what'll drive me crazy is if he, like, they go away from this.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
if he has some
kind of emotional breakthrough. And I don't know, because they keep on... they keep on showing Mira and how worried she is, and I've long thought that the reason they've kept Mira around is that she is going to serve as some kind of bridge back to humanity, that he's going to be tested in some ways. Because you see, so a guy who can say you looked really beautiful the night that Ramsay tortured and raped you is the same kind of guy that could talk to the Night King in a vision and be like, okay, I see your point. You know? Like if you lose your humanity, like, maybe the Night King's proposal of whatever he's going to do, we haven't got there, I don't have any book knowledge, I don't have any... You know, like, I think they're laying the point to where when you see Bran start to go down this path, if he goes down this path, it's not going to be a giant what the fuck moment. I wish they'd had another 5 or 10 minutes here and there where they could show his descent.
Right, like trying to avoid a what the fuck moment down the line with a what the fuck moment is maybe not the best strategy.
Right.
But yeah, I see your point. It could be that we are looking at the Night King very differently than Bran will. You know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, anything else you want to say about Bran and Sansa under the tree here?
Nope.
Okay. Then we go on to the Maester examining Jorah, who says he started feeling better just out of the blue. The Maester pronounces Jorah well and releases him, and then he tells Sam he'd like to speak with him later, and Sam asks Jorah where he's going. Jorah says, "I'm going to be with Dany again." Sam shakes his hand before he goes. Nice moment.
Jorah possibly shoring up her military weakness?
Okay. Maybe. I don't know. How good is he?
I mean, he has combat experience because they talked about him fighting in Robert's Rebellion and with some distinction. So the fact that Tyrion really has one battle that he's been in.
Yeah.
It was a doozy, and he employed weapons of mass destruction, but it's not, you know, he's not like Jaime or Randall Tarly. Like, Jorah might be that solid kind of, like, you know, nuts and bolts and logistics and strategy and tactics kind of guy that she's lacking right now.
Could be.
Because Varys ain't that guy either.
Nope.
Grey Worm's not really that guy. Grey Worm's a great... I think he's a good leader, but I don't know that he's got he was never taught.
He's great at execution of other people's strategies.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think it's I don't think it's any disrespect to say that someone has been taught their whole life to be that. It would take more than a year or two to get all that, you know, to be able to think for yourself sufficiently to have that kind of grand strategic vision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jorah doesn't have that either, but he also wasn't trained from an early age to not have it. So,
right.
I just wonder if he, you know, there's a couple of things that Jorah could be. He could be the thing that makes Dany realize John's not a bad guy.
Uh-huh.
He could be her military advisor. There's a lot of things. Hell, she should send for Dario. Dario would probably be better at, or at least a good counterbalance to Tyrion.
Yeah, Dario.
Dario's sneaky.
He's sneaky. He struck me as a guy that you want doing your espionage.
Right.
I know that, Varys is very good at that, but his network is sort of cut off.
It is.
I don't know how much of his network he has left, because he seems to have some of it.
Gendry needs to stop buying his rowboat, row him over with a bag full of sweets, and he needs to start winning those birds back to his side.
And I thought this was a good moment. Sam has, you know, faith in himself, much like Dany does, that he has done the job correctly.
Yeah.
And then when he shakes Jorah's hand, he's not instantly going to come down with grayscale.
I thought, and that's, you know, that's a big thing for Jorah. How long has it been since he's had human contact?
A long time.
I mean, it's like a little bit of the Jesus curing the leper kind of moment.
Yeah.
And he goes for the double hand grab because he hasn't been touched since the Stone Men. So,
yep.
I thought that was nice. It was a nice moment between the two.
It was. Then the Maester later that evening scolds Sam for treating Jorah, but also congratulates him on the success of this difficult procedure, and his reward is he gets to stay and clean the scrolls of paper / flesh mites.
Mm-hmm.
Paper mites apparently love flesh as well.
Yeah.
They should really be called a misnomer.
Flesh mites. Yeah. they'll make do. It's like I eat tofu.
Right.
But I certainly don't prefer it.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a tofu-ivore. I'm a carnivore. So what's going on with these rotting scrolls? Is this Archmaester Ebros's middle path to letting Sam through to restrict? I wonder if these are very select old scrolls.
They're clearly very old, because they're rotting.
Because I guess I was surprised. I thought that Sam would be kicked out because of this, and then that would free him up to do whatever he needs. But it seems like there is yet more things for him to learn at the Citadel.
I hope so.
Old rotten scrolls that no one's looked at for God knows how long seem like the type of place. Yeah. I guess my only question is Ebros in on it? Because it seems like he's got a newfound respect for Sam, and he was not inclined to just dismiss. You know, his thing was oh, Sam, you're worried about nothing. It's more like, have perspective on what you're worrying about.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way for Sam to go. You know, it's always been his head that's made him different than everybody else. His, you know, he's a bookworm. And he likes that stuff. And I think if he can get an opportunity to excel through that, that's a great way for his story to go.
He's the paper mite, just devouring scrolls one after another.
Yeah. Then we go to Dany, who tells her advisors that she wants to go after Euron's ships on her dragons. They think it's a bad idea because she's too valuable. Tyrion describes the attack as it would go down if it were straightforward. I'm talking about Casterly Rock here.
Yep.
He also describes it exactly how it actually goes, using the back door that he built into the sewers.
Unfortunately, it's not actually super better.
No. I mean, they win. They take Casterly Rock, but they lose ultimately because it's a trap. They take the castle, but their fleet is sunk behind them, and the Lannister forces have vacated in order to take Highgarden. So they gain a worthless castle with no food, nothing in the larders, as Jaime says.
Well, here's the thing.
They lose their fleet.
In voiceover, when Jaime was saying it's essentially a worthless rock, I felt like you could hear Tywin spinning in his grave.
Mm-hmm.
Because he would be the first to say a house that can't keep their fucking house is going to be not respected.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there's going to be that's going to be a problem. The fact that like they just let their ancestral home be taken, that's going to be the Lannister name has already fallen quite a bit. Like, at what point do the lords start to see a weakness? Like, why are we fighting for these two weird incest babies? Like, why don't we, like, it's the Lannisters don't have money or armies or bread. We have the money and armies and bread.
Yeah, not anymore, though.
I
think this Highgarden move is brilliant on their part.
I do, too. But
they've used Tyrion's own prejudices against him.
Right.
And I think they've gained something far more valuable than Casterly Rock in the process, which is Highgarden and its, stores of not only gold, but also food.
Right.
I think it's a super good move.
If
people in the land, if the lords of the land can't see that, I mean, I wouldn't put it past them.
But that's what I'm
saying.
Like,
but at the same time, they're idiots if they don't see that.
That was one of the things that Tywin tried to teach Jaime. Like, perception is the truth. With these, you can say all you want, oh, I meant to lose my house. But at the end of the day, you lost your house, and you're not getting it back anytime soon. And also... Is it common knowledge that the fucking Lannisters are broke?
They're not broke anymore.
Well, but you know what I'm saying? Like, the fact that they just let their castle that's got all the gold mines and all that. Like, I don't know. It seems like...
Oh, you mean people didn't know the gold mines were empty?
Right.
Because they had been telling them
that they're not. That they're a paper lion this whole time. And now the whole realm knows that can't be good.
So they think, oh my God, they've taken the castle on top of the gold mines.
Right.
There go the Lannisters.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
It's because essentially this goes back to Varys's parable about you got the rich, the rich merchant, the king, and the priest.
Mm-hmm.
And they both tell a sellsword to kill someone who has the power in the situation.
Right.
And the power is where the people think it is. Well, the Lannisters have just essentially say, yep, we don't have any clothes.
Mm-hmm.
We're a bunch of brother, fucker, and sister, naked people, beggars. And House, Randall Tarly's not a stupid man. He's not a scheming man.
Hmm.
But I just wonder if that's going to be part of their downfall.
He's still got that oath hanging over his head. He took a vow to the crown. And Highgarden's not around anymore. Or the Tyrells aren't around.
Right.
So it's his only oath left, I guess.
Yep. What's your stance on the fact that they yada yada'd through one entire battle and then they kind of did this weird alt history version of the other? I thought it was cool. I thought it was a great use of a budget where you can, because I felt like seeing the Unsullied assault Casterly Rock both ways was very cool, and it made Tyrion look smart. But they just immediately undercut it by making Jaime look smarter.
Yeah, sure. No,
he's a disaster of a hand so far.
Yeah, terrible. He's lost both of the battles that he's been in.
Right.
And the fleet is entirely gone.
And
no boats.
He also would have lost Meereen had it not been for Dany coming back with the dragons.
Right.
So he's actually 3-for-3 failures as a hand.
And Dany now has no options. This is like coming to the mainland and burning the boats behind you to keep your people there and on task. She now has to win this thing, right? She's on Westeros for good.
Mm-hmm.
Unless she just wants to say, peace out. I'm taking my dragons back to Essos.
Right, yeah. You
bye,
know
Dothraki.
What?
Bye,
fuck y'all. I'm going back to Meereen.
Right.
I'm going to marry Daario and not care about this stupid continent ever again.
Yeah. I mean, two of the branches of her army have been destroyed already. And now she's stuck there.
Yeah, she
much
had,
like Jon.
Yeah, she had. I mean, now she's like, that's the thing. Like, Cersei's flipped the script on her.
Yeah.
She, like, now she has no allies except for Jon, who isn't an ally yet. He's a prisoner. But Tyrell's neutralized. Dorne neutralized. She has no navy, so she can't even use her Dothraki screamers anymore.
Her army is across the continent from her. Or a good chunk of her army is.
Right.
Now, I'm sure she has a ton of Dothraki.
Mm-hmm.
And she's always got the dragons. But
right.
she doesn't want to kill people. Like,
right.
She doesn't want to kill civilians. She's in a really tough spot.
That's the thing. Like, Tyrion's advice, which was good advice, has essentially forced her to do the thing that they didn't want to do anyway.
Yeah.
So, like, it's arguable that as brutal and terrible as unleashing the dragons and her foreign barbarians, that would have ultimately led to less bloodshed. Plus the idea that that's just something I don't think we talked about last week, the idea that Tyrion would say, oh, we should just lay siege to King's Landing. Well, we saw the last time. No, I know we did talk about this. The last time they laid siege to King's Landing, people starved and died. The small folk didn't like it. Well, why would you think that, you know, the fact that you're being besieged by the Tyrells and the Dornish would be less acceptable than a bloody and terrible battle that then would immediately put King's Landing back on an economic map? It's tough. Tyrion's just not looking great.
No, he's not. He's looking real bad right now. The only thing he's got going for him is he built the sewers in Casterly Rock.
Right.
And he knew about that, so they took it a little easier than they would
have. Yeah, he had a way to smuggle whores into his bedroom that Grey Worm is able to exploit.
We've already talked about how quickly Euron sailed around the world.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the line that reminds us of what Bronn said, give me 10 good men and I'll impregnate the bitch.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great line. Great line that brings us back to a great line from another great character.
Yep. And then we immediately see that character. He's right beside Jaime.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Randall Tarly, I didn't notice that the first time I watched. He's right there beside him riding up to the gates of Highgarden.
Yeah, I was so focused on Randall Tarly.
I know.
Like,
I couldn't
believe
I missed Bronn back there.
Yeah. So, yeah, they take Highgarden. Jaime then takes a little bit of time to chat with Olenna before poisoning her.
I love the Reigns of Castamere playing as Jaime's doing his very stylistic and heavily edited walk to her chambers. That's just a very cool moment.
That chase cam.
It did a lot
really
of show
cool.
and not telling because you saw the gold, you saw the grain, you saw the men laying on the ground dead.
Yep. And he, you know, he poisons her. He's giving her a distinguished, I guess, death, a painless death.
Right.
But before she dies, she reveals to Jaime that she was the one who had Joffrey killed. She poisoned him in a not so painless way.
Yeah.
Fantastic scene here. This is a great cap for the episode.
Yep. I feel you. I think it needed a little bit more. I don't know. Maybe they don't. They were like, well, maybe Jaime should kill the old woman, but then how will the audience, like, what? I don't know what they're trying to do with Jaime yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And it could be that they didn't want to play their hand about, like, how good or evil or what he's going to even do. Like, that they're just piling on insult upon insult and, you know, all these things that, like, Jaime's turning into a fun. And that's the thing, like, Jaime never wasn't a bad guy. Like, he, from a young age, wanted to do the right thing, arguably served the realm, and got vilified for it.
Yeah. We're seeing a lot of, like, season one Jaime here.
Yeah.
Just taking insult after insult when he doesn't deserve them.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, Jaime became a person that throws a child out of the tower. Like,
right.
But I don't think that's the true Jaime. I think the true Jaime is the one we've seen that's fair-minded and wants to do what's right, and he's being subverted by his love for his sister, which is, I don't know, it seems kind of suspect, but I think Lady Olenna said it, that, like, they're portraying it as a true blue thing. He's almost blind in his devotion.
Yeah.
And also, I can see him, like, you know, I never really had the mind for politics of my father. Maybe Cersei's better at that, and, you know, at the end of the day, is anyone really going to care about what war crime she committed when we all live underneath the Queen's peace?
Yeah, that's kind of what he says.
That's exactly, yeah. So I mean, kind of see him thinking, like, well, this is how everyone, like, I saw how Robert got to the throne. I know how Aegon got to the throne. I know how the First Men took the. I know how the Andals. It's like it's never like, oh, these came up and be like, hey, the way you're doing things are kind of jacked up. Maybe we need new leadership. Oh, you're right. We've been fucking things up here. You sit on the throne. Like, there's always terrible things that happen. It's war.
Yeah, and nobody's ever come up and said, hey, excuse me, King.
Right.
I'm actually the rightful heir here. Yes. Could you please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Vacate the throne for me.
I've been sitting here this whole time. Let me get. I've been keeping it warm for you.
Right. There's always bloodshed.
And also, it's like he could probably happen. Like, you know, I never thought he was a great student in history, but also you could rationalize, well, the victor's always right to history, so that we're probably getting the cleaned up version.
Yeah.
Like,
I want to see what his page looks like now in the Knights of Westeros or whatever.
Well,
he's
the Lord
was.
Commander. He's the one supposed to be writing it. I don't think. There's
he
just
hasn't
been
kept
crayon,
up on it.
There's just been crayon drawings.
Yeah. doodles of lions everywhere.
Right. Yeah. He'd be writing his name. Nice. He'd be writing his name, Mr. Jamie Lannister or Mr. Cersei Lannister. I don't know how would you do that.
J Hearts C.
Yeah. Forever.
Oh, man. Wait till Sam gets his hand on that book.
It's not BFF, FFF, Family Fuckers Forever.
Wow. All right. And that's the end of the episode.
Is Jamie going to tell Cersei?
About Joffrey?
Yeah. Why would he?
He can't. Oh, he can't. That'll drive her mad.
It does serve this purpose because she's convinced that Tyrion did it this whole time.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So I don't know that would make a difference when it comes to Cersei. So I guess is the reason Jaime's reeling about this because that's the thing. It's like, is he reeling because he now knows his brother is innocent?
I think he's reeling. Just because the whole scope of it is just crazy, you know? Like, he's found out a lot of information here.
Yeah.
He didn't have before.
Right.
Doesn't know how to react.
Right. Yeah.
But that's... I think he kind of already knew that. Like, why else would he... I don't think he would have helped Tyrion escape.
That's true.
The King's justice.
Right.
If he had not known that already.
Really thought that he killed, yeah.
Yeah. We do know that he... He does hate Tyrion, but for different reasons. For
yeah, and I wonder. I guess what I'm saying. I wonder if this is we're supposed to see. This is Jaime starting to turn. Like if some of the stuff that Cersei's been banking on being untrue, and the fact that maybe in his mind there was a shadow of a doubt that like, well, he killed my father, and now he's turning traitor against the family in a way that he's never, you know, because they've always like you know Jaime and Tyrion have always liked each other, but Tyrion's always been on the side of his family, even though they treated him horribly. But I don't know, maybe.
Yeah,
I'm not quite on board with what they're doing with Jaime and Cersei here, so it's hard for me to puzzle out.
Well, we'll see. Probably sooner rather than later. That's the end of the episode.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, everybody, real quick before we get to the feedback section, we've got a sponsor today to talk about. It's a new one, so you haven't heard this one before. I was sent a box of RX bars, and if you're wondering what those are, they're protein bars that actually taste really good. They have a whole bunch of different flavors, like 11 of them, I think, maybe 12. They have a limited time mango pineapple one that sounded good.
As many flavors as there are seas in Planetos.
At least that many.
Got the peanut butter sea.
My favorite flavor is actually the mixed berry. I think that one's really good.
I like the peanut butter. I'm surprised because the peanut butter already has that kind of like dry mouth effect. But these bars are so good that it's just the natural peanut butter flavor was great.
Maybe it's because they have no gluten. I don't know.
Ooh.
What does gluten do? I'm not an expert.
It retards the taste of peanut butter. Get it out of there.
But I got a sampler box of them. I think there were six different flavors in there, and I tried them all except for peanut butter, which I haven't got to yet. It's the last one, but you tried that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of them come with cashews, which you're allergic to.
I'm allergic to cashews.
So I got to eat the bulk of them, which was nice. So basically what they are is they are a whole food protein bar. So they have a lot of protein in them, mainly from egg whites, which is nice because it's easy protein to digest, and it's actually doesn't have a ton of calories in there as compared to the yolks, not a ton of cholesterol, which is nice. And they're all natural, so there's no artificial flavors, no artificial coloring or preservatives or filler or anything like that. Each bar, if you look at the front of it, has like a list of some of the four kind of base ingredients, one of those being the egg whites, which is a major one. You have like cashews or some kind of nut, probably a peanut in there. You have a lot of dates.
Cacao
if it's a chocolate one, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of dates, which give it a nice sweet flavor as well. These are probably – I'd have to say they're probably in the top tier of protein bars that I've tried.
And here's the thing.
I've tried a lot of
If you're not familiar with protein bars, don't order these and expecting to get like chewy granola.
No, they're different.
They're protein, but these are the best I've ever tasted. And here's the thing that separated from me is like – the fact that most protein bars I eat and I immediately feel like I have to drink a gallon of water.
Yeah.
Because they're so dry.
They taste like protein.
But this is like you said, they're all natural, so they actually look exactly like, it looks like they took the ingredients on the front and smashed it down into a bar.
Yeah, you can see whole cashews in there.
They don't dry out your mouth. They're moist, and that I think that actually helps their flavor too. I tried the chocolate one and the peanut butter, and I thought they're both really good. I tried some just eating, and then I took a couple boating with me this weekend for a river snack.
No, I've been eating them for like quick breakfasts. They're mm-hmm. super easy to just grab on your way out the door. I've been eating them for snacks like at night. I think they're awesome. They're really good protein bars.
And you're ripped now. And shredded.
Let's say I'm on my way to being shredded again.
You're like 6 months of Rowan Gendry. Not quite six seasons, but you're getting there.
Yeah, I'm getting there. And the RX bars are helping, I think. So, yeah, if you would like to get 25% off your first order, you can visit rxbar.com/GOT. And when you check out, enter promo code GOT, and you'll get 25% off that first order. I recommend them. I think they're great protein bars. They're all natural. They're healthy. Go for it. Do we have feedback to do?
Oh, do we? Let's go ahead and get started with it. Michael R., why hasn't Randall Tarley gone or at least sent someone to Old Town yet to reclaim his priceless Valyrian steel sword? He knows exactly where Sam is. I can't believe he's just chalked it up as a lost cause.
Yeah, he didn't notice it. He never noticed it was gone.
Sam just put a stick there, a right? little twig, yeah. A pussy willow branch, and he just uh-huh. it's something up there. I mean, is there an argument that he might have, but, like, if you look at the chronology, he would have been summoned before Cersei. I know why he wouldn't send, because he could send probably the shittiest fighter in all of his retinue to mm-hmm. get it, and he would easily hand Sam his ass and get the Valyrian steel sword. And
yeah.
I don't have a clear answer to this, because it is weird that they conspicuously showed Sam stealing it. And we know how crazy valuable these are, and what an insult that would be for Tarly to endure that his son that he has treated as some effeminate, fat waste of skin his entire life has stole the family heirloom. Mm-hmm. That not even some of the richest houses in West, like for the longest time, the Lannisters didn't have any until they stole fucking Ned's sword. They didn't have a bit of Valyrian steel. Hard for me to understand. So yeah, I don't have any good theories for you.
And to add injury to insult, insult to injury, that's mm-hmm. the phrase. He's not doing anything with it.
Right.
Right? Like, granted, I know it was sitting on the mantle, but it was impressing people.
If you use it to debride Jorah.
Right.
It's the sharpest thing I have, Jorah. I've always wanted to use it. All right, moving on. Charlie from NYC. I think that Arya will meet up with Sansa at the end of the season. Happy musical play, and we'll see a smile on her face. They'll hug. It will be beautiful. Then Sansa will stab her in the stomach. She steps back, feeling her wound. Sansa removes her face to show it's a faceless men. Her story at the faceless men cannot be over, and I have a hard time believing they'll be okay with her running around Westeros using their techniques.
Sure.
Do you think the faceless men are going to pay Arya a visit for stealing their secrets? And
I think they should try. Yeah.
The thing is Jacken seemed pleased with what she was doing.
He had a smile on his face, but
You're doing everything that I wanted you to do the entire time. I was teaching you wrong as a joke somehow, and I
you could also interpret it as like the game is afoot kind of smile.
True,
like,
true.
Aha, we have a worthy contender. Now I have to go kill her.
I just, they're a death cult. Mm-hmm. And they've got a member who is not playing according to the rules, and that seems like it should be a problem.
Yeah. You have to. Every person that Arya has killed, Jacken has had to take life. He's got to pay for life with death or something. I don't know. Or he's bringing people back to life over in Essos.
That would be interesting too. If like she is fucking up some kind of scales that they're keeping track of, and it's going to mean. Some atonement has to be done for people that she cares about. I don't know. That's a good question, Charlie. Your guess is as good as mine. I will say that if we never see the faceless men again, I'm not going to be complaining because I never particularly liked the fast forward version of her training that we got. I thought there was a lot of, kind of plot holes and illogical development. And you're right. That smile was enigmatic, and it's a faceless man, so who knows what it means.
Yeah.
Dave from Canada, just got done listening to an instant take and couldn't help but notice your fascination with the bridge on Euron's flagship. Just for your interest, the name of that device is called a corvus, which means raven, and was invented by the Romans in the first Punic War as a way to combat the experienced crews of the Carthaginians, Jesus, a hard word to say, by turning a sea battle into a land battle with their marines, where the Romans demonstrated a marked superiority.
All right. Pretty cool. Good idea.
I guess it's called a corvus because it, just like Euron's deal, has this giant spike that once it penetrates the deck, it's like you ain't getting away.
Yeah.
Caitlin from Tennessee. Okay, guys, I had a thought. Sansa said she learned a lot from Cersei, right? One of the things Cersei told her very early on is about the power men have or women have over men and how Sansa better learn to use it. What if Sansa marries Sweet Robin? They're supposed to anyway, and old Sansa's like, ew, no, but new Sansa's hopefully smarter and more strategic. She told Brienne that Littlefinger was there because we need his men, but they aren't his men. She married into the Vale, she gains control over Littlefinger, and the lords and ladies are hers. They don't like Littlefinger and owe allegiance to the Starks anyway, and this effectively cuts him out. So it's a way that Sansa could have him thrown out the Broken Tower just as Bran was.
First of all, Robin, no, ew. he's still ew.
Hey,
but
yeah,
this is a good plan.
If she can fend off a notorious lech like Tyrion, then...
Yeah, I mean, because Tyrion helped her out with
like,
that.
What's Sweet Robin going to go for a kiss? She just backhands him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he cries.
I just think being in his presence is kind of ew.
The other thing is, the kid. That's dangerous because his lords, I mean, it's not like she's going to marry him and suddenly be in charge. If he gets in a fit of pique and says, I want to see Sansa fly, they're going to throw her out the door.
For sure, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, how much did she learn from Cersei and how much has she learned from, like, Margaery? Because Margaery was very good at controlling Tommen, for instance, right?
Yeah. I feel like the target of her manipulation will probably be more Littlefinger than Sweet Robin.
You think so?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think it could work. I don't think that's a terrible plan on her part. And it's something that I don't think Littlefinger would really see coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he talks a good game about fighting every battle in his head everywhere all the time. But I think she could maybe throw him a wild card with that.
Right on. Ernest T., do you think we'll see a potential Dothraki rebellion? In a rousing speech to the Dothraki in the desert, Dany promises they will kill men in iron suits and tear down their stone houses. But it seems like Tyrion's plan is in direct opposition to this. There is no mention of the Dothraki in any of Tyrion's plans. With them being sidelined and Dany essentially not fulfilling her promise, do you think there could be some conflict?
Nah. I don't see it, but, I mean, potentially, who knows?
I mean, that's the thing, like, she won them onto her side by this miraculous show of magical power and dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're going to be true blue. Now, I guess the question is, if she has no boats and there's no way to procure more food, you know, an army marches on its belly. If you've got potentially 100,000 dudes with their horses on this tiny island that doesn't have anything in the way of arable farmland, What are you going to do? What are they going to do?
Yeah, they got to start marching somewhere. But...
And also, the other question you got to ask yourself, do Double D's know or care about any of these logistic things? Because increasingly, it seems like they don't.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, eh, it sounds about right. Let's go with it. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. So,
yeah.
Men starving on beaches, not cool. not unless you're Christopher Nolan and you're making Dunkirk. Let's move on. Jessica M., here's the deal. I figured it out. Euron uses those magical sponge ships that grow when you pour water on them. You ever play around those things? You get like I've seen them. Those little eggs you get, and like you put in two quarters, and like you got dinosaurs, and it's dumb. It's like, you know, you pour water on them, and they're slightly larger versions of themselves.
Uh-huh.
But sure, he doesn't even have to pour water. He just has to throw them in the ocean. Instant fleet.
Yeah, just get damp hair over there, rubbing his
hair all
over those things.
Squeezing
That'll
his
work.
Hair out. He needs two quarters to put into the machine. He's got all the ships he needs.
D hair, come over here.
D hair.
What are you doing tonight? We got 1,000 ships we got to raise.
Yep, you got the damp hair, so make it happen, buddy. Chris S. I was surprised by your views on the scene about Jon not telling Sansa. Of course, if you didn't know, this is old business about the last episode that we hadn't gotten to. About Jon not telling Sansa about his decision before the meeting, I saw it completely differently. This is a good take, Jim. I believe Jon had a specific agenda and reason for saying all of this in the open meeting. By not telling anyone, he got an honest reaction and dissent from Sansa in front of all the other lords who shared that opinion. That aligned her with the other lords, so when Jon announced he was putting her in charge, she was immediately accepted and trusted by them. By doing this, he showed everyone that she could be a strong leader, plus Sansa's honest reaction shows that she wasn't colluding with Jon, which could have made her a target of the revolt to his decision.
What?
It distanced her from him, allowing her to stay in Winterfell as a strong and trusted leader in his absence.
Hmm.
I thought this was a pretty good reading of the situation.
So, yeah, I also read this email, and I think it was it laid out a fairly good case for why Jon might have sprung this on her. Look, if you're going to follow Jon, and Jon says Sansa's in charge, I think you follow Sansa.
Yeah.
I don't think you say, well, they could be colluding. Well, colluding? what do you mean you're willing to follow John?
Right.
To the ends of the earth, essentially. Like, and I don't think anybody was going to turn traitor on John if he just said, I'm off to Dragonglass Land. You guys can just sit tight for a while. Nobody's in charge. I'm still in charge, but I'll be back.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's going to turn on him.
But someone has to be left in charge.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But my point is, like, I don't think anybody is willing to mutiny on John because he's making decisions they don't agree with.
Probably not. But, like, if things go poorly and he gets killed, then the lords are like, well, Sansa tried to tell him, let's rally around Sansa, versus if they had formed a unified front and she says, well, you know, I was, you know, you guys didn't know this, but I was said
sure,
he was stupid for going down there, then they might just like dismiss the whole Stark house as we need new leadership. I don't know. I thought it's the best defense of them not being on the same page I saw.
It is, yeah.
Moving on, Rhaenys. Bran and Arya reveal to Sansa the sins of Littlefinger, and Sansa is now the Warden or Queen of the North. Would she be able to pass a sentence and swing the sword as Ned or Jon would have?
Oh, shit. Wait. We've got to talk about fighting all the battles in your head all the time as it applies to Bran. Because he's done this, man. You're not going to pull one over on Bran, right? Like, Littlefinger's got no chance. And if Bran gives a shit about what Littlefinger is doing, Littlefinger's fucked. There's nothing he can do that Bran hasn't seen.
I wonder if that's what they're... That's a good point. I wonder if that's what they're getting with his detached humanity, that he has all these puzzle pieces, but he can't... Just the same way he can't put the puzzle piece together that your sister looked beautiful on the night she was raped. He can't see that, like, all these things that he knows about Littlefinger. And also, I don't... If all this knowledge was, like, jammed in his skull, does that mean, like, he has equal access to it all the time?
Right.
Or are some of these, like, murky memories that he has to think about?
Or does he have to go specifically look at a thing, like, warg into that moment?
Or does he not see the significance of it? Like, I'm fixated on the war to the north, so, like, all this stuff with Littlefinger is not processing.
I mean,
it's
probably
computing as a threat.
It's a good thing for Littlefinger that Bran is so detached, because he gets a glimpse of that moment when Littlefinger betrayed Ned, and boom, it's over. Your head's coming off, Littlefinger.
Yeah.
But Bran might not care anymore. I don't know.
Your question, though, Russ, about whether she would have to pass a sentence and sing, I'm sure she could pass a sentence because Jon gave her command authority. Mm-hmm. I don't think she'd be expected to swing the sword because this is a patriarchy, and I'm sure there'd be a lot of, like, don't you trouble yourself, little lady. You done enough work passing a sentence. I'll swing the sword for you. But then again, she's also got Lady Mormont that's probably like, what is this bullshit? Yeah. You take that sword and you hack his head off.
Or I will.
Yeah, or I will. That would be interesting.
I will say it's a good thing the sword isn't like twice as big as her now. Like, she's grown up and the sword has gotten smaller.
Right.
Because that looked like a heavy ass. I don't know if I
could
lift that
sword.
Well,
that sword is now
gone.
It's too far.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bethany says, I listened to your discussion of the John and Danny marriage potential and I felt your con list was rather short, so let me help. John and Danny getting married makes sense political, maybe, and prophetically, but do you think of two people who are more like oil and water than these two? Let's review the tape. John was raised from the dead and still assures people that he's not a god. Danny survives a fire and Vase Dothrak, totally open to their worship as if she's divine. 2. John follows Davos' skepticism about Mel's prophecy despite his knowledge of her power. Danny meets Mel for the first time and is totally sold on being the princess that was promised. Mel's not even pushing Danny in that position, but Danny is eating it up. 3. John consistently judges people as individuals, not as members of a class. He sees the humanity of the free folk and gives the rebellious houses a second chance. Danny's entire conflict these last however many seasons has been about the masters versus the slaves. 4. John shows no delight in killing, even in war. He even said in this episode that I don't like the things that I'm good at when he's good at killing folk. He couldn't kill Ygritte, even though she was an enemy combatant. John O'Slint deserved to die, and John still had to gather strength to do it. He hung the people who literally stabbed him in betrayal, and he seemed grim and sad the whole time doing it. The only exception might be his beatdown of Ramsay Bolton, who deserved much worse than he got, and John stopped himself before killing him. Danny, on the other hand, is happy to watch her enemies burn alive. She crucifies the masters, and any masters will do, again judging them entirely according to their class. She feeds one of the masters to her dragons, without any trial or even spy intel knowledge of their guilt. Her first instinct is in every case is to burn them all. The best you can say about her is that sometimes she listens to counsel. John says he himself had never wanted to be king and never asked for it. Danny's been asking to take what is hers for the last 6 seasons. These are not mere personality differences. These are evidence of diametrically opposed core values. Pretty compelling.
All fair points, and I think until this episode I had not I had seen hints that maybe Danny was on that train, like it's all about me kind of thing. This episode really drove it home for me. And I think the comment from John about not enjoying what he's good at is more than just killing people. Yes, he's good at killing people, but he's also good at leading people.
Right.
And he doesn't enjoy it. He doesn't want to be the leader.
Right.
But he's got to be in this moment. Whereas Danny is the exact opposite in that regard.
However,
she wants to be the leader.
Do you know what are two diametrically opposed core things? Ice and fire.
Right.
And this is the song of ice and fire.
Yeah.
So I also looked at your list, and I'm seeing maybe a couple points where John could step closer to Danny.
And vice versa,
and maybe Danny could step closer to John, so maybe you know, we'll end up with a song of slush, and everybody will be happy. throw some cherry on there, some grape, you got yourself a snow cone. Who doesn't like a snow cone?
I'd bet Danny would like a snow cone.
I bet Drogon wouldn't, though.
No, probably not.
Jessica D., Arya's list was discussed in your Season 7 preview podcast and again in this week's podcast, but I think someone was missed both times. Wasn't the Red Woman added to Arya's list in Season 3 after Melisandre took Gendry?
I think so.
And Melisandre predicted that she and Arya will meet again. Is Arya going to be the
with Varys' face?
If Melisandre, I mean, she's heading. I think she'll make it to the Volantis fine.
Mm-hmm.
She comes back then, according to prophecy. Her and Arya has to meet, and she has to die. Why wouldn't she die to Arya?
I can't think of any real reason, unless she's got some magic up her robe sleeves.
Strangely detached from Melisandre.
Strangely detached? I've never liked her.
Okay, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I guess that's what I mean. Like, for someone who's had a central role, I'm very ambivalent about what I, you know, she's done very terrible things, and she's done, yet I think I can understand why she's deluded. Like, she had real power, and it seems like she had the Lord's blessing. So, you know, history is not exactly lacking of people doing terrible things because they think they have God's approval.
Mm-hmm.
And who can say that they would resist that? Like, if, you know, I started shitting out magic babies, I'm comfortable with my atheism, but that would make me question what I know. Maybe I would start doing terrible things.
Maybe.
I don't know. It's itchy, but I feel very, very kind of ambivalent about her.
Yeah, I'm fine if she dies. Like, Arya, I kind of don't want her to live. Like,
Arya killing her, though, doesn't, like, there's a couple things. Like, Arya killing Cersei, yeah, I could get behind that. Arya killing the Freys, super cool. Arya killing Melisandre is like, meh.
Yeah.
I mean, there's like Arya killing the Hound, outrage. Be outrage at this point.
Yeah, I do not want that.
But Melisandre would just be like, meh. I don't see her making it out. She's made too many mistakes. Burned too many. Like, I can't forgive her for burning Shireen.
What's she going to Volantis for?
I don't know. Fashion.
Really?
She's worn the same outfit for 6 seasons now. It's time to time to try something new.
Come back with an army of red priestesses.
A winter. She needs some fur on her collar. She needs some more wintry garb. I don't know, because that's
going to be in the theater.
I bet it's to be called onto the carpet for what she's been doing in Westeros.
You think so? She's reporting to headquarters.
I mean, that's where we first met the other red priestesses and priests.
Right.
That became kind of Danny's source of power and amongst the people in Essos. Why else would she?
Maybe a debriefing. Maybe she wants to get some knowledge over there of what's going on.
Hmm.
Exactly. I don't know. They seem to have a pretty... I don't know. They have other ways of communicating,
I mean,
I'm sure.
I would love to know more about the hierarchy of the church.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's awful late in the game for me to care about it. So I have kind of mixed feelings about... I'm just all mixed up about Melisandre. George N., maybe my memory is failing me, but it seems like characters are using out-of-world words this season, like Euron saying nation in Season 7, Episode 1, and Tyrion saying country in Season 7, Episode 2. Am I way off base, or are these words out of place? Usually they're words like realm or kingdom, so these usages struck me as odd. I actually didn't know how to answer your question, George, but there is this tool called A Search of Ice and Fire. And it has a full text of all of George Martin's works, and you can search it for any word or phrase. And I used nation and country, and turns out shit tons of references of – and not country like the countryside, like speaking of it as if it is a state. So I – when you read that, I'm like, huh. Yeah, it sounds like the double D's to take, you know, some linguistic complexity and just play havoc with it. But – lots of precedents in all the canon works of George using these words like we do. So,
okay.
And also check out Search of Ice and Fire. If you Google for it, I'm not sure what the URL is, but it's a pretty cool reference for answering questions like these. And B, while watching Cersei and Jaime standing on a large map of Westeros, I was wondering, with all the Game of Thrones mania going on, what percentage of Americans know the map and geography of Westeros better than a map of England? Or better than even a map of the U.S.?
I think it's very few. I actually, unless I was doing this podcast, I would not know where anything is in Westeros. I would know north, I would know south, I would know middle.
Right.
But I wouldn't know east or west from each other.
Right. So, and we're bad. We're bad people to ask because we're pretty good at geography in general. I'm sure I could find some random English.
I don't want to claim that.
I'm sure I could find some random Englishmen and women that were pretty poor about understanding their map of their local geography.
I can tell you where.
But yeah, it's a fair point. People do tend to spend too much time on trivialities.
Yeah.
In a world full of real life complexity and drama. But you take your escape where you can find
for
it.
You. Yep.
Exactly. Chris K. from Placenta. No, not Placenta.
What?
Placenta? It's too close to Placenta for me, Chris.
I didn't.
California.
There's probably a city in California
Placenta?
Named Placenta. Yeah.
Yeah?
That seems like the state that would name a town Placenta.
Probably. Yeah, it's named after consuming placenta. That's a thing now?
That's a thing.
People are eating their placentas.
Melisandre does that from time to time.
Oh, yeah. It's your shadow placenta?
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's the best parts.
It really is, yeah.
You cook it just right, so tender.
So
all
smoky.
Right. I don't like the sounds of your town, Chris, but we'll consider your feedback. On the full cast this week, you mentioned that Sam is a Mary Sue representation of Germ in the books and wondered who the Mary Sues for the Double Ds are. I think I've got it. Dolores Ed and Dario Naharis, because they were left behind with the monumental task of manning the wall and ruling Marine. Just the Double Ds are left with the task of finishing a story that Gurm started over 20 years ago. That's not bad. Because they were both are kind of like, what, you're just going to leave me with this mess? Fuck you, John. Fuck you, Danny.
Also,
like
they're the Double Ds, Dolores and Dario. Dolores, I never know how to pronounce that.
Boom. Me either, but people always give me shit no matter what I say. That seems like a good t-shirt idea. The Double Ds with the I don't know how to
I mean, people would point their fingers in the air and say, but his name's Ed.
Right.
It's not Dolores Ed.
Yeah. You know.
Whatever.
Double Ds aren't their real names either. Although there's Dan and David. DB.
Yeah.
All right. Jay Snyder. I've long thought that Sam was a literary stand-in for Gurm, and the last episode only seems to confirm that. My prediction for the last shot of the series is we see an elderly maester Sam completing the Song of Ice and Fire and pull back to reveal Gurm appearing in person as the old Sam. He looks at the camera
with
and says...
With the hat or without?
With the hat and the turtle, the full thing. except for he's got the maester's robes and chain.
Right.
And he's chained to a desk writing this thing. And he looks at the camera and says, boy. I didn't think I would ever finish it, and the internet crashes shortly after. That's the thing. If he was able to get the books done by the final season, that would be a great moment.
Uh-huh.
Like, I could totally be on seeing actual Gurm as a wizened old maester finishing it. But there actually might be a war started if that cameo happens at this point. Like, there's just no way.
Yeah.
There's no way you can do that. That's just like bull baiting your fan base. All right. Ardeni, maybe I'm missing something from the books or the early season of the show, but would you care to discuss why you think people have such a tough time believing in White Walkers? I get that it's a long time ago in history, but people have seen magic and dragons and have heard at least whispered reports and confirms these legends that they've heard. It's not like our stories we hear where there just isn't a lot of time passed, but also little scientific eyewitness and other evidence to suggest that, say, the entire Earth was flooded except for a boat that holds two of each animal. This is a world where there are still people alive who have seen dragons. People can worgen animals. People birth shadow demons. Somewhere, someone knows someone who contracted the faceless men. Dragons have been flying over land and sea. People avoid Ashai because of the mystic arts practiced there. But White Walkers and Whites are a bridge too far for people? Why is it so hard for people to accept that there's a looming threat up north?
I don't think the wall helps, honestly. I think all the
piece
people...
of complacency.
Well, yeah, probably that as well. But I think all the people who would attest to any kind of weird happenings up north are blocked from coming south.
Right.
And so you don't really have the legends that are as strong in the north of, you know, the north, the quote-unquote north,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to north of the wall.
Yeah, there's
like
also...
those people believe in those things, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a little Star Wars-y where, like, Han Solo should have been a small child during the Age of the Jedi, but yet he's dismissing all this as hokey religion and ancient, right. You know, when he's talking about it, like, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah.
And people, they say, well, that's not a plot hole. That just shows how ruthless the Emperor was at stamping out the Jedi religion and changing history, like cult of personality style. And there's hints in the books that the Maesters have been doing something about that with magic, mm-hmm. because it's something they can't understand and control, and it's something that seems to be on the way out. So they're very interested in kind of, like, pulling man away from looking at this mysticism and stuff and putting it firmly, you know, they're trying to start their own age of reason over there. So an in-universe explanation is that these Maesters are trying to use the temporary reversal of magic in the realm as a way to kind of, like, finally they can be, like, overthrow the priests and all the superstition and be a new ruling power in Westeros.
Also, it's been a much longer time since the White Walkers have been a thing than dragons.
Right.
So
and look at, I mean, here's the other thing. We live in a world that's built on reason and intellect, and yet we still have people that on both sides that deny scientific proof. And also, how up are you on string theory? How up are you on dark matter and black holes? Like, there's lots of things that are almost indistinguishable from magic that happen. I mean, how many people can articulate what the theory of relativity means, general or special?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's plenty in this world in the margins that none of us really understand except for a select few, and we're content to have that happen. But, like, let's say that, you know, whether you live or die tomorrow depends on whether you can believe to your bones in, like, quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
How many of us are going to survive?
Yeah.
And that's kind of like this. It's something that, like, yeah, sure, there's dragons, sure, there's this, but now there's an existential threat based on something I've never heard of before. It's, I don't know. Like, I guess I don't see it as weird as other people to think that just because there's some fantastic elements in the world that you would just naively believe anything that someone, you know, you'd just be credulous that something you have no personal experience with could be happening.
I do think maybe the people who have directly seen the magical things that are happening in this universe, like dragons, for instance,
yes.
should maybe lend a little more credence to the idea that there could be other things out there that they don't quite understand, and that they're possibly real. Now, I'm not saying, like, they need to go make that their core identity.
Right.
Like, Danny doesn't need to magically say, oh, the White Walkers are coming, yeah, because I've got dragons, obviously. But she might, you know, open her mind to the possibility of them.
Right.
Because of the things she's seen in association with her dragons.
But there's a perfect example in this episode. Like, John says, man, if I'd only known the things that were north, I wish someone had told me. This story begins with a man from the Night's Watch running south to tell everyone the White Walkers are coming, and he's dismissed as a charlatan and fraud and executed by the oh-so-righteous and wise Ned Stark.
Mm-hmm.
And that's super ironic that Jon Snow is saying this. Like, oh,
right.
If only someone did try to tell you, jackass, and you offed with this. You were there. You were standing there, and you watched it happen.
Uh-huh.
So do you hate Jon Snow? Do you think he I just feel like it's – I feel like it's pretty natural. And it's easy to see, like, a supernatural thing for us, like dragons, and, like, well, then Katie barred a door. And I don't think they that live in this world view their world like that.
Sure.
You know, any more than we – like, we have lasers now. We have laser guns. Our world's not magic.
No.
You know? We've sent a man to a moon. That doesn't mean I can levitate and blast fire out of my ass. Wish I could. Andy S. Sir Loras was one of the best knights of Westeros. The Tyrells seemed to fight well enough when defending King's Landing from Cersei. How come they're now a bunch of flower boys who fight like crap? I don't mind they lost to the Lannisters, but I don't get where the comment on them not being able to fight come from.
It's because Mace was the only one left training the troops, and he's just... You've seen him on a horse. He's terrible.
Right. He's sir too lame to sit a horse.
Yeah.
I think I got several emails like this, and I think the thing you're missing is that the bulk... There's a couple things. Historically, the Tyrells are not well liked in the Reach because the Gardeners, who are the lords, the king of the Reach,
mm-hmm.
Fought against the Targaryens in the Field of Fire, so named.
Oh, that sounds bad.
Because Aegon first unleashed his dragons and annihilated instantly like three of the kings in one fell swoop.
Wow.
And then he rode to the castle of Highgarden. He's like, all right, who the fuck's in charge? And the steward said, I am. He's like, guess what? You're the new lords of the realm. So these and you'd imagine the other lords, like the Tarleys, and they're seeing this happen, and the Stuarts are made the lords of the realm, and they have to bend the knee to the fucking King Stuart. Mm-hmm. Like that didn't sit very well, and it's not exactly a brilliant piece of geopolitical game that the Targaryens played. But also, I think you're missing the fact that Randall Tarly is he made off with the bulk of their army. And he's their best military commander. So it's not the Tyrells at full strength against the Lannister army. It's whatever's left in their personal guard and the people who garrison the castle against most of the other powerful lords of the Reach and the Lannisters combined taking them over.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I mean, Olenna definitely seems to have a negative view of the fighting prowess of her troops.
She does.
Even the good ones. And I always got the impression that Loras probably learned to fight so well kind of to blend in, to disguise himself.
True.
You know?
Yeah, he butched it up.
Yeah, that it's obviously not acceptable for him to love men in that universe. So, like, he probably used that as a bit of a cover.
Sure.
I imagine. He was probably better than most of their other knights, right?
Also, the other thing is, like, they made it a point in season two when Kat went to go over, you know, to go treat with Renly. Like, you know, they're holding this tournament, and she's like, oh, man, look at the boys of summer trying to fight. Like, a lot of it is also, like, if you take Randall Tarly and his badasses out of it that actually went through Robert's Rebellion, you've got a bunch of younger people haven't even seen a winter. So they are... I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. The fact is that most of the good Tarleys or most of the good loyal bannermen went over to the queen, Cersei, and supported her, and that left Olenna with nothing.
Yeah.
So, but I got that a lot, and I just wanted to make sure I explained it a bit. Andrew M., if Jon Snow's parents are Rhaegar Targaryen and Lyanna Stark, wouldn't they need to marry in secret for Jon to actually have a Targaryen name? Otherwise, since they had him out of wedlock and he's technically still a bastard... technically a bastard? No, I mean, so this is the thing, like, and you'd need to join us over into the spoiler section to get a lot more of this, but, like, there's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's not unheard of for Targaryens to have two wives. Fuck, Aegon Targaryen, to start the whole thing, married both of his sisters. And had children from both of them.
Of course he did.
And it's not something, that's the thing, is like, that's one of the reasons that Targaryens were always weird, because that was an anathema to the entire rest of the realm.
Yeah.
The incest and multiple wives are not cool to any of the faiths in the Seven Kingdoms.
Except Dornish. The Dornish are probably cool. Yeah, Dornish with some
like, yeah, well, I don't know. Your sister, dude, but okay, multiple yeah. wives, I can kind of see it.
Right.
But they also didn't bend the knee. They were the last to bend the knee. They never did bend
the
knee.
They never did, yeah.
And it's also interesting that the generation of Targaryens that ran out of dragons are the ones that started having trouble and started being pressured, and then you had the Mad King, and it was very easy for the realm to, like, all right, done with the Targaryen nonsense. So, but we don't know. We don't know. There's lots of people to say that you know, Aelya Martell was fine with with Rhaegar going to marrying Lyanna, and that they were married in secret, but nobody knows.
Also, how strict do you want to get with this? Because technically Sansa is a Bolton at this point.
Yeah.
So what the fuck? If you're going to call her Sansa Stark, you can't harp too much on Jon Targaryen.
Right. She's a witch. She's Bolton's widow at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that there's so many technical questions, and also, like, if this is to fulfill a prophecy, does the prophecy care about marriage? Is it the bloodlines?
Sure. Yeah.
And we don't know any of those questions. But I also say that, you know, I think people put way too much emphasis on this birthright and bastardry, and especially, you know, when you've got a bastard that's the king of the North now, that should tell you that. It's mostly who has the best leadership qualities and who can get the most amount of men and weapons. It's not about your bloodlines.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. Just Stephen M. I just finished watching the episode, your instant take, and wanted to write in about Littlefinger's intentions. In a scene of the new Maester of Winterfell says that the Maester Luwin kept records of every raven that ever came to Winterfell. While I may have been moved past quickly in the scene, it certainly got Littlefinger's attention.
Did it?
Well,
I missed that.
Yeah, he had like a bit of a
his eyes bugged out of his head.
A little bit. It seems clear to me that this is a resource he's going to use, but the question is, to what end? Could it be connected to the Raven that Catelyn Stark's sister sent in season one? Perhaps it was sent. Raven was sent to hire an assassin to kill Bran. All these are crimes that could potentially link Littlefinger, which he may want to erase now that Bran's back in Winterfell.
Hmm. I was coming at it from the other side, not erasing, but learning. Yeah.
Well, because that's the thing. These Ravens, I doubt they were sent to Winterfell, so Master Luwin would have seen it. I mean, if there was something in there like, your sister sent in a message, something about her doing the bidding of Littlefinger and destabilizing the realm. I don't know. You read it.
Yeah. I don't have time for that.
I don't think there's smoking guns in there, but also Littlefinger did certainly react to something there.
Okay.
So, but also there's a person there that potentially knows everything about everything that could blow. There's so, as I said, like, I'm a little back on like, well, maybe we should respect Littlefinger, but boy, he is really out on the thinnest of branches.
Yeah. Yeah, with Bran there.
And it's half sawn through.
For sure.
But we'll keep an eye on that, see what happens. Joy A. My question is, an opening sequence, the clockwork of King's Landing still shows the stag sigil of House Baratheon. It made sense when Joffrey and Tommen were kings, as they were believed to be Baratheons, but it's clear that the Lannisters sit the Iron Throne now. Cersei never took the name Baratheon, and she's called Queen Cersei Lannister, first of her name.
Gonna do the name game again, huh?
So why is King's Landing not have a line on the clockwork? Honestly, I'm disappointed too.
I've read an article about this.
Oh, enlighten me.
And they essentially said that they're disappointed in it as well.
Okay, good.
The production crew.
Okay, cool.
And I think it's just an oversight. Yeah.
Okay, because they were very smart about switching Winterfell to Bolton and back.
Right.
And now, like, the windows in the Great Hall have been replaced with the seven-sided star. They now have Lannister lions. So, like, I'm glad to hear that it's an oversight, because it is. It is. And I wish they could fix it. Honestly, they act like it takes $1 million to change the intro.
You just got
to
change that one piece. We know what the trick is here, guys.
Yeah, like, I don't think it's a literal clockwork thing that some dude has. I think it's a render.
Yeah,
so how hard is it to retexture it and re-render it?
It can't be that. I could do that.
Like,
I
don't know that it's too late to fix right now is what I'm saying.
Right.
Like, why the fuck don't they just fix it?
Yeah.
Anyway. Suzanne H., the thought just hit me, since we didn't see Arya tonight. What do you think is the possibility that she's the Iron Banker? I know we want to see Jaime off Cersei, but I'll take what I can get. I think it's low, because why the hell would Arya go through this whole charade of...
Yeah, why let her out of that room?
Yeah. Like...
They're alone.
She should have died.
Yeah.
She should have died.
But, interestingly, I hadn't even considered it, and I probably should have with all those faces floating around.
Well, that's the thing. I'm saying, no, we shouldn't. We should really calm down and face switching. Like, just because, again...
Until they start abusing it, I guess, yeah.
The mechanic exists in the world, but that doesn't mean everybody... I have no interest in turning this into everybody, somebody else face podcast. And I've already done it twice in the feedback section, so... Joey from Virginia Beach. So after Sam cures Jorah of his grayscale by removing his infected skin and applying an ointment, the Archmaester to Citadel mentions only a small handful of maesters have ever successfully performed such a procedure. And we see that Jorah's cured body looks similar to that of a person with third-degree burn scarring. However, Stannis' daughter Shireen had her grayscale cured in an unknown way, or possibly a combination of several different ways, and her face still had a large patch of cooled lava skin look that had been removed entirely from Jorah. This implies there's more than one cure for grayscale?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, didn't the Archmaester made that specific? Like, you know, Sam was trying to talk about different techniques, and he's like, well, do you know, that was a child versus a full-grown man. That was a initial stage versus an advanced stage. Like, I do think that there are treatments for grayscale. Some of them might be as crude as hacking off your limb that's affected.
Right.
I think they can cure it, but once it's like all through your torso, it's like curing, you know, stage one cancer versus stage four, and it's metastasized and in your lymph nodes. It's like, you know.
No, they made that explicit. They said you've waited a long time. You could have chopped the arm off or whatever an episode ago.
Right. Stephanie R., I understand why Euron would want to marry Cersei to become king. Obviously, being king of Westeros is a good gig, except for the whole everyone who is king kind of dying thing. However, I'm assuming Cersei's too old to give Euron any children at this point, so he'd have no heirs to the throne. Who would become king or queen of Westeros if he and Cersei were to die?
I don't know that he's in it for the dynasty.
The dynasty.
I think he's in it for himself.
Yeah, like if you're on might be one of those types, like those truly psychopathic types that think like when they close their eyes, the world disappears.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think he gives a shit about anything that happens after he dies.
Or happened before he was born.
Right.
None of that. All he cares about is conquering, killing, and receiving the glory.
Yep. Yep. So, and also, I just, like, one of those two will betray each other before it becomes a dynasty.
Yeah, for sure.
Becomes part of the package. Audrey T., during the storming of Castle Rock, Casterly Rock, Tyrion quotes, "Give me 10 good men and I'll pregnate the bitch," and attributes this line to a good friend, who of course is Bronn. And then it's a great throwback to the good old days that was dampened when I saw Bronn riding alongside Jaime on the way to Highgarden. What do you think will happen if the two inevitably meet up? Bronn has admitted to liking Tyrion more than Jaime, but Jaime is Bronn's meal ticket. What do you think in a scenario where Bronn and Tyrion are back on the same side?
Bronn chooses the winning side. So whichever he perceives as the winning side. And once he gets a load of those dragons, he might turn on Jaime.
Right. Especially since Jaime's been doing a lot of promising and not a lot of delivering.
Yeah, as far as we've seen. Yeah. You know, he promised a better castle and a better wife, a prettier wife, or whatever Bronn wanted. I don't know that he's gotten those yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Bronn is just amoral.
Yeah.
Like, if all of his amoral tendencies equal out, he'll go with his personal preference. But
sure.
If you like Bronn, you're overlooking the fact that he has no code that he follows.
No.
Except for he wants to be the one standing after the fight. So... Mm-hmm. Tyrion's already been on the wrong side of that equation. It could happen again. It could happen to Jaime.
Yep.
So I think you're right, Jim. Whichever's got the higher percentage is going to be the one that gets his loyalty. Stefani K, have you seen the images released by HBO on the cure for grayscale? So this is something they do on their website where they have, like, you know, just in-universe explanations for stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It detailed the scrolls that Sam said he was following, and it talked about all the steps and the tools you use.
Huh.
And here is the unguent recipe that he followed. It's one. It's part pine resin, bark, beeswax, and olive oil. Stefani says, why does the cure for grayscale sound like salad dressing?
Yeah.
Whatever happened to the ingestion of dragonglass that was hinted at the episode one of the season? I would like to know your thoughts.
That's what I'm talking about. We don't know that there's dragon glass in there. Apparently there's not.
I mean, so what she's talking about is when you freeze framed on the books that he was reading, you saw half a page where it's implying that obsidian had some medicinal properties.
Right, in episode one.
In episode one. And people were saying, oh, well, maybe that's going to be part of the cure for great. And then we get, you know, again, it does sound like some sort of salad dressing. I don't know that. That's so weird that they would pay attention to that in the stuff that you have to pause and blow up and read, but then their official marketing material would then undercut that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I view it just as a nod to the book readers.
Yeah,
who maybe.
Although I'm a book reader, and that nod meant nothing to me. Like, obsidian being used for medicine was. Yeah, that's nothing.
Oh, I thought that was part of.
Dude, we're so far past the fucking books now.
Well, there's still relevant stuff. I thought that was one of the things.
Yeah, but yeah, there was no hint that it's got any kind of medicinal properties in the book. So I was like, oh, this looks interesting. It looks like it's paid. Now, the other thing is this marketing stuff. I don't know that the Double D's see that as canon.
Okay.
So maybe obsidian as a medicine will be back on the table. I assume the thing's actually shot in frame on a camera. Even if you have to freeze frame them and blow it up, those are canon.
They should be.
Who knows? Connor F. I honestly felt like Bran felt more like a kid who had been tripping acid for the last week and finally came home after seeing time is constantly happening and he can just go back and potentially fuck shit up. He felt very disconnected, and I wonder if the more he goes into the tree network, the more he stays behind, like Winnie Wargs.
He went to 1,000 years in the future and just had the sickest rave.
Bottom line, he reminds me of every douchebag in high school that discovered jam bands and acid. Call me the Blood Raven now. you're not wrong, Connor. You're not wrong.
Yeah.
Colby, curious if you discuss what happens to the whites if the White Walkers are killed. Do they,
if all of the White Walkers are killed,
the White
that's
Walkers
a good
are
question.
Killed. Do the Whites turn back to human, or do they fall over? Do they turn to dust to become friendly zombies? No one knows because not all White Walkers have been killed.
Yeah.
So, you have a hypothesis. We will put it to the test.
It'd be pretty smart of them if that's the case. Like if all the Whites just drop when they're right. down, to maybe leave one in the back. You know, maybe don't leave all your generals up front, all your officers.
But you know, a gloating based language implies a certain type of pigheadedness and
that's
refusing to admit that you might be defeated or wrong. I can see that. That seems like the type of fantasy trope that this show would lean on, like killing the Night King and then everything just explodes to dust.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're animated by some magic. What is the source of that magic?
Right.
Can it be destroyed if it
if
can?
If the children are all dead now and the Night King is the last bit of it, then when he's gone,
right.
you know, surely you don't have to hunt down every last white, every last desiccated corpse still drawing a rattling breath and kill it.
That would make sense. Now, it doesn't have to be the case.
Nothing in the book. Yeah. Like I said, and the books are like, we are so far beyond the books as far as White Walker lore. It's pathetic. It's crazy how little we know about them in five books worth of information. So, Kelly, one quick observation prediction I hope doesn't come to fruition. Do you think Sansa is pregnant?
No. Answer no.
I mean, she could be. I would not be a fan of that plot line. I don't understand why having her being pregnant with Ramsay's rape baby would be interesting from her character development. Or like, I think it's time for Sansa to rule.
Yeah.
So no, I don't like, but it gets suggested all the time. So I just want to like once per season address it, deal with it and no, it could happen. I don't want it to happen. I'm not going to talk about it unless it actually does happen.
Okay.
Unless I see a bump, see a baby bump and then we can talk about it. Nick L, obviously not everyone believes John on the existence of the White Walkers, but couldn't it be a possibility to save humanity for John to suggest that everyone immigrate to Essos? The White Walkers don't exist in
Essos.
That's
a pretty big
correct?
Ask, I think.
Yeah.
Hey guys, I know we got awesome castles
plus
and
like half the fleet
and...
of the entire continent has been burnt.
Right.
But so here's the deal.
Just as a precaution, maybe you pack up everything you own and you move to another continent.
Right. So there's a couple deals here. Number one, all the different prophecies, like the prince that was promised, the stallion that mounts the world, the Azor Ahai, the last hero, these are all from very different cultures spanning the globe. It's like saying when the Ice Age came, the glaciers were only a problem for North America. Super not true. If the Long Night comes, it's eventually going to affect. Like Essos might not get it right away, but it's my understanding that eventually the whole globe will freeze and there will be no humans left because the White Walkers will hunt them down and kill them all. Like, no, like even the equator won't be safe. So, no, fleeing to Essos would not buy you anything but the smallest bit of time. Jennifer C., do you think there's a chance that we will get scenes from the White Walkers' perspective to understand them better? We know that they are the real threat to Westeros and more important than the Game of Thrones, but I'm still having trouble understanding what exactly they want. I'm unclear whether they're robot-y things whose programming from the Children of the Forest went awry and now they're just killing machines, or whether they have their own goals or world domination or something specific. I think it'd be cool to see a scene about them from their own perspective to explain more about their motives. I mean, you're not wrong. It's very common to note that George Martin very rarely deals in absolutes and good or evil. And to the extent that the White Walkers, if they never get more character development, they already are kind of that pure evil, pure malevolent force. So one argument could be like, well, it's about time we get one. The other argument is like, well, we'll see a side of them that we don't know yet. So if they're not sympathetic, we might understand at least what they want.
Yeah, I think we're set up to get those through Bran. I think he could potentially just be, you know, that an observer,
right?
For events in the past, maybe, you know, we go back to why a little bit more of like why they more like expounding more on why they were created. I know we already kind of know the base reason for it, but like what happened shortly after that, you know, the
right.
We know that there was a war fought. We know that at some point they got out of control.
But maybe they were also beaten back.
Right. And they got under control again. But maybe we could see that through Bran's perspective. I don't think we'll ever get I know we have got scenes of just purely White Walkers, like that baby scene, right? Mm-hmm. Where they took the baby back and turned it into White Walker. I think those are going to be few and far between. It's probably going to be more through Bran.
There is some tantalizing hints of their humanity. The fact that they wear mm-hmm. clothes, the fact that they have these geometric shapes that are important to them, the fact that he did the whole double arm raise, come at me, bro, to John. Like, uh-huh.
Yeah, they have a culture. I just don't know much about it yet.
So I guess the question is, and the other thing is, I think, Jennifer, you seem adventuresome enough to join us in the spoiler section. Because it's not like I got a lot more to talk about, but like I'm kind of handcuffed on what I can and cannot say on this podcast. So maybe you would be a good candidate for joining us over there. Eric V, did Tyrion imply that his father built Casterly Rock and that he, Tyrion, designed the sewers? I remember he was in charge of them when he was younger, but I thought the castle had been around for like a million years. Yeah, that was ambiguous. Casterly Rock's been around for a long time. In fact, the name Casterly Rock implies that it wasn't always Lannister. In fact, the legend goes that Lan the Clever tricked the Casterlys out of the rock somehow through some kind of, I don't know.
Like the Millennium Falcon.
Multi-level marketing scheme.
A Sabacc game.
Yeah. Got him selling LuLaRoe. They went bankrupt. but anyway, I think when he's saying he rebuilt the house, it's more like successive generations of Lannisters had run it into the ground, including Tywin's father, Tytos, and he rebuilt it. Like he found it brick and left it marble, but he didn't renovate the shitters.
Okay.
And the sewers. Yeah. So no, he didn't build Casterly Rock, but it's 'cause like I said, I'm kind of bummed the way they visualize Casterly Rock. The fact is it seems like it's a whitewashed castle. But I don't know. But in this universe, you could also maybe he did. Maybe he did build what is now known as Casterly Rock.
I don't know.
No one does. Maybe. Yeah. It's like I know in the first few seasons the Blu-rays had these like really cool charcoal drawing featurettes about the history of Westeros, mm-hmm. and they went into Lan the Clever and all that. And I think that was even read by Charles Dance. So I know the Double Ds are aware of this history, okay. but whether they decide to keep with it or not. But I also think, don't you think that Tyrion's that I'm not completely crazy that you could read that into Tyrion's statement that it's not like he built the castle, but he rebuilt it from a place of kind of ruin or disrepair.
Yeah, it's like the song, you know, they didn't literally build the city on rock and roll,
right?
But they built the city on rock and roll,
right? And it has a traffic report in the middle of the song about the city's traffic of rock and roll.
Does
rock,
it?
Rock and roll traffic jams. That. You don't remember that?
Uh-uh.
Well, it's better left not discussed then. And that's feedback for the week.
Okay.
If you'd like to send more, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. Of course, you can always talk to your fellow fans on the forums at forums.baldmove.com. Follow everything that we do at baldmove.com or on social media, facebook.com/baldmove. Twitter @BaldMove, Instagram @BaldMove. And yeah, we are not done this week, though. We will be back with the spoiler section on Friday. Again, we are not trafficking in production spoilers. So if you've been avoiding listening to that just for that reason, spoilers, we do not consider the production spoilers and the leaks is not what's considered. In fact, it's really constrained our speculation, mm-hmm. which sucks. Like, this leaking shit is really it hasn't diminished my enjoyment of the series, but it has made my life as a podcaster that's trying to be ignorant of all that stuff tougher, and it's sucked a little bit of the feedback joy from me.
Yeah,
wish we lived in a world that's not leaked, but unfortunately we don't. Like I said in the housekeeping section, it's getting worse.
Yeah. No, even more leaks, hacks, and all kinds of things.
Whole episodes are being stolen, so be very careful out there. You know, I actually almost saw a big spoiler from the fucking Facebook, just shared something from the next episode, just a naked spoiler from the leak.
Yeah.
That's not
what our group is for. There's a lot of places out there that you can go to for production spoilers. That's not what we're doing.
Yep, exactly. So we'll see here Friday for the spoiler section. If everything goes planned, we'll have a guest from the insider, actually. Kim Renfro is joining us to talk about her.
She's
favorite.
Got all the leaks.
She's got all the leaks.
She's bringing them.
And she's going to play the reins of Castamere as she as she signs off of Skype. But that's going to be fun. We did a couple panels together down at the Con of Thrones, and she's really sharp, and she likes the fun theories like I do. So I thought we'd have a little conversation. Maybe we'll do some more stuff with her. We'll see.
Yeah.
Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you Friday.